23rd, 2019, Arizona State Board for Blacksburg Secondary Education is called to order at 10 a.m. Board top majority vote of qualified members may go into executive session for the purpose of obtaining legal advice pursuant to ARS 3-1-0-3-8-3 on any matter on the agenda. The board upon a majority vote of qualified members may also go into executive session to discuss or consider records exempt by law for public inspection, including receiving testimony that specifically requires being confidential by federal state law pursuant to ARS 3-1-0-3-8-2. The board reserves the right to change the order of the agenda to the section of the ARS. Are there any questions or the agenda? The board to discuss and take action on any agenda. The meeting has been recorded. I'll ask the board members and staff to introduce themselves for the record. Yes, Minister,
Kevin LaMountain, staff. Keith Blanchard, board staff.
Glenn Tharp, board member.
Mike Romano, board member.
Trish Leonard, board member.
Dr. Jennifer Light, board member.
Nick Lukey, board member.
Attorney General Frankie Schenekberg, attorney for the board.
All right. And those who are on the phone, if you please put your phone on mute, we would really appreciate it. Not hold, because then we'll hear whatever your hold music is. No, it's not personal. My brother is 50 years old today. Now it's like officially in a recorded message, so I can make a hold.
Appreciate that.
Except for the record.
Board members should also state their name when making a motion, seconding a motion, and when voting on issues. Board meeting minutes. Is anyone interested in making a motion for the acceptance of the official minute of the board meeting from April 25th, 2019?
So moved.
Seconded. All met.
So a motion and a second. All in favor?
Mike Romano, aye.
Glenn Tharp, aye.
Almond, an aye.
Dr. Jennifer, like aye.
Dick Lupke, aye.
And Ms. Sanfield, have you confirmed that it is posted? And the April 25th executive session meeting minutes?
Glenn Tharp, second.
All right, we have a motion second. All those in favor of accepting the minutes?
Glenn Tharp, aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Trish Leonard, aye.
Almond, an aye.
Dr. Jennifer, like aye.
Dick Lupke, aye.
The first item on the agenda, Arizona Summit Law School, and update regarding the...
You
introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, I'm Peter Gopler, president of Arizona Summit Law School, and I'm here to present an update. It's an end of term update as requested back at the January meeting by the board. At the start of the spring term, Summit was responsible for 17 students. 10 of whom were enrolled as visiting students at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Florida Coastal School of Law, and Arizona State University. And there were 7 students who had opted not to attend classes during the spring term. They were subsequently officially withdrawn per U.S. Department of Education policies and were advised of their options under the Department of Education closed school discharge rules. One of the remaining 10 students withdrew from classes midway through the spring term and has indicated an interest in transferring, and he is in the process of doing that at this point, and we're providing him all of the appropriate support for that transfer. The other 9 have completed the term. We're waiting for the grade reports and the transcript submissions from the schools and by those students. And we're actively working with those 9 students regarding their progress towards their degrees, including the completion of the specific required courses. Particularly, in almost every instance, the requirement that they have 6 credits of experiential learning, and we're in the process of helping several of them be placed in externships this summer. The others are working on placements for the fall term. As with everything else, those externships would be hosted, or would be supervised rather, by host schools, but we're providing, since several of those students are here in Phoenix, we're providing the connections and the support to get them placed in the externships. It's also there are also among those nine students, several of them that we are aware are working on the possibility of transferring during the course of the summer as well, and we're of course helping them with letters of good standing and transcripts and so on. We're also working with a number of alumni on a regular basis with regard to bar applications, transcripts, career services support, and so on. And finally, we've filed our application for license renewal with the board and have responded to several follow-up questions. The final thing is the Arizona Summit students taking the Arizona bar for the first time in in February had a 45% pass rate, and I believe that the state pass rate was 45%. But we don't have the final details from the state. That's the overall pass rate. We don't have yet the details from the state on the first time pass rate. New Mexico is typically the second largest cohort of our graduates taking the bar for the first time, and we're still awaiting the official details from the state of New Mexico. And with that, I will be happy to respond to any questions that members of the board have.
The one person transferring, so that means that he or she doesn't want to stay under the regime.
That is correct. That's correct. And there, as I said, there are probably as many as four others who are also working on that process. And a couple of them, I'm pretty sure, will be successful in doing so.
Are they transferring to the school they're currently visiting at?
Unclear with regard to. At least a couple of them. There's one student that is visiting it here at Arizona State University who we're pretty certain is processing a transfer application there, and given his credentials, I would think would be accepted.
Unfortunately, that one
couldn't
have been
with our
parents. And that was a student that we had actually preceding the start of the teach-out, had had difficulties communicating with, had had some challenges interacting with him.
So he may still join the 7 then as potentially someone who doesn't make it through?
It's possible, although he, the last communication that we had with him, he indicated that he was fully intending to complete his degree and was actively seeking the transfer. I know that last year at this time, we had a number of students transferred to the University of North Dakota, and the University of North Dakota has, over the last couple of years, been pretty aggressive in both seeking and accepting transfer students, and I suspect that there are at least a couple of students that are looking at North Dakota as an option. North Dakota has been far more flexible than most schools with regard to the credentials of transferring students and the number of credits that those students would be able to transfer.
So the 7 who withdrew, did you also appoint them to the state for any of their non?
Yes.
Have we received any?
No.
At this point, when are you anticipating completing the teach-out?
We anticipate a year from this time. And we're working with all the students to make certain that they stay on track so that they can graduate. The ABA indicated that it would continue the accreditation of the school for purposes of the teach-out through May of 20.
When do you anticipate hearing back in regards to your renewal application?
I'm not sure what the...
Oh, our renewal?
Is it through us?
Okay, yes, yeah, that was the state license renewal.
Okay.
We're working.
I misinterpreted what they had applied for. Okay.
How many students, just to be sure, because the document says 17, do you have one of those dropped?
No. So we started the term with 17. Seven of those students were subsequently withdrawn per Department of Education.
Yeah, 10 and one that left.
10, yeah. So it 10 because we're still kind of tracking the one who dropped out in the middle just to make sure that he is indeed doing what he says. But it looks as though going forward, at least over the course of the summer, it's 9 students.
Expenses is the school incurring to complete the teach out, and the follow-up to that is given the recent audit, the parent company, the loss was $64 million in 2018. I'm just wondering, does the parent company have enough resources to see this through? Because of the 3 schools that started out, there's only one.
Yes, that is correct. But yes, there are sufficient resources and a commitment from INFALA to continue to support the teach out.
So if INFALA declares bankruptcy because it was a going concern portion to the audit, there's some kind of provisions there to just assure that students who are still in the program or in the teach out would be able to.
Yes, that's my understanding.
And you're prepared to stick it out all the way another year?
That is the plan, and I'm also doing other work for influence and providing support to the Florida Coastal in a variety of ways.
I don't have a question, more of a comment, is based on everything that we've seen over probably the past year. I just want to comment on the fact that you guys have planned out a teach out. You guys have continued to watch that teach out. You followed up on that teach out. And I honestly am thankful, based on how we've seen other things go, that you guys continue to do your best to make sure that these students are taken care of. So I actually commend you on that.
Thank you. We're very committed to doing so.
All right, thank you. And
thank
when
you
do
very
you want
much.
To come back?
Oh, the beginning of the fall. So the October meeting, you come forward with the result of course, and then with the externships over the summer, and by then you'll know who's secured.
Yes, certainly by that time we'll have a very very clear idea as to where people have landed and which students we're still specifically watching for purposes of completion.
And your update was very very good, so keep that going.
Made it easy.
Happy to do so. And in the meantime, obviously, if there are any questions or anything that staff needs us to do, we will respond promptly.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Next item on the agenda is Charles of Italy.
Yes, ma'am. Charles of Italy. Their license renewal at the January meeting, had requested several changes to the enrollment agreement and catalog, which they provided to us, as well as to submit in-house financial statements for your review. And I do believe I said that Frankie Bartholomew and Scott Pickett were present. However, I do believe they're on by call, because they're in Lake Havasu City.
Yes, Scott, are you on?
We're here.
Thank you. So we don't have a lead, it's just an update. So one of you would like to give us a brief update?
Sure, yeah. The like discussed before with Terry, the in-house financials that you got were not completed. Because our auditor, we put in things that we're not sure, we're not accountants, so we just put in ask my accountant, and then at the end of the year, she goes through and she checks all the stuff that we didn't know what to do with. So once she was finished with her part, as you can see with the document we supplied, it's different numbers than what you guys originally seen, and I kind of made that. This is not the first year we've had to do this because of this. We had the same issue last year just because she didn't get it done in time because just the way the calendar falls with the auditor and with the accountant and with your guys' renewal process, it just pushes it a couple months away. So it makes it a lot harder. But we got all that with the right numbers over to you guys. And then we fixed a couple things on the enrollment agreement that were asked of us. And the catalog.
Can you ask who it is who's speaking, please?
Scott Jacobs.
Thank you. Yeah, meeting's being recorded, so we just have to be sure we know who is speaking.
Okay.
Have we received an updated catalog and DA? The one
yes, you
document
have.
Is from January?
It is, yeah.
It's just dated that, but that is the most current one that we have. And, Scott, the one we talked about here in the last couple of weeks, this is the updated document, right? The one you did the checklist?
Yeah, everything that I sent over to you is the one that me and you work with.
So when I reviewed that from the one that's in our drive versus the one that was provided in January, it is the same with no changes, so there is still a difference between the EA and that. So it's probably on our side, Mr. Jacobs, so I just wanted to kind of notify that I was unable to verify that those changes had taken place with the EA and the catalog, specific around one policy, in particular, for example, item number 3, where on the EA it has that they will retain $100. And on the in the catalog, it says all monies will be returned. And then they also have, and there may be a reason for this, so I just wanted to verify, that they have different percentages for their refund policy than what the standard calls out for.
I think,
well, if I may, I'll go ahead.
Does yours have written numbers
on
the checklist?
Yep. Yes.
Oh, it does?
Are there written numbers on the catalog?
Looks the same as ours. While we're looking at, when you
marks.
Update a catalog, it's important that you revision note or version number so we know.
Same. Right. They didn't change the effective date.
It can be that effective, but they should have something that says, you know, revised in a date or updated in a date. It just makes it very difficult to know what we are looking at.
What makes it difficult for us is they have all their programs, even the ones that we don't license, on the enrollment agreement in the catalog. So it encompasses all the different scenarios. In talking with Scott, the accreditor requires they want one catalog. And Scott, if I speak out of turn here from all of our conversations, is they require all their programs to be in one document.
So do you guys on your checklist.
Right, but I'm
if you go off your checklist for the catalog, it says all programs listed.
So what do you currently show on your EA under the refund policy number 3? Do you show that you will retain a $100 fee?
Let's see here, number 3, yes.
Okay, and now if you go to the catalog that you provided to us, or at least the one I believe is the right one, and you go to page 28 of that for the refund policy, I'm just getting there now, so I apologize. I'm pulling it up electronically here.
Scott, you want to...
And it says, number 3 says you will refund all monies paid to the school.
Yeah. Right. Scott, you need to explain the difference between how these two policies interact because of all the different programs you have in the enrollment agreement catalog. So it covers, one board requires something else, we require something, the creditor requires.
So essentially what happens is pretty much everything that we have in any part of our catalog was taken verbatim from the documents that our creditors given us every year, which is NACIS, and they give us documents every year. They're like sample documents and tell us, hey, you need to follow these. We've already created them for you. There's no reason to recreate the wheel, essentially. So there are some things in there that are based off of that, and usually the verbiage and all this stuff that we've had confusion on is verbiage out of those sample documents that we've used. The catalog that you're looking at now, we're actually working on getting rid of to a newer one, which Keith had talked about, that we're going to a whole new one that's been redone off of the new documents for the accreditation and working with the Department of Education right now for our review. So I might have accidentally not put it in here just because I've been dealing with your guys' board, the U.S. Department of Education, NACIS. We've been doing three reviews all at the same time, and we're trying to work on creating a new catalog and while trying to fix the stuff that we're giving to you, just so in a month or two we can give you a new catalog with all the new stuff again. So it may have just got missed when me and Keith were working on it together. I thought I had switched it to where it matched, but this catalog that you have will be gone as soon as we're done and get the approval through the Department of Ed for our new one that's coming out.
I would just ask staff to continue to work with them in regards to clarifying that. I would also call out that my experience has been usually it's the more stringent of the policies, and right now the school in their catalog is calling out that 10% and below, they're retaining 30% of a refund versus the standard that calls out that it should be 20%. So they are retaining more based on what their catalog states than what our state policy calls out. So I don't know how to get to the clarity on that one, but I just wanted to make the staff aware of that.
Non-accredited institutions are the 90-80-76. The accredited institution goes by the accreditor, Department of Ed.
Okay. So they are not held to...
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That. Thank you.
I also think, just as a general editorial to what you're speaking to, is that we should... The documents need to match. I mean, they have to, some of the verbiage in the catalog has got to be the same as the EA, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all on.
Yeah, and we'll have that corrected. Like I said, we're working on a whole new one that should hopefully be out in the next month. It's been submitted to the Department of Ed for review. And then after their approval, it goes to accreditation for their review. And then once they approve it, we'll send you guys a copy with all the updated and changes to it also.
Are you going to update the date? I mean, change the date from January?
Yeah, we'll change the date.
And it would behoove you going forward, the catalog might have an effective date, but if you find, you know, errors or something in it, you need to fix it. You should have something that has a revised date, and then maybe at the in the back, you say what page number you made a change. So it just makes it very hard. If you have two catalogs that both say they're effective January 1st of 19, literally we would have to do a page-by-page comparison to find out what you changed. And I have no idea when it is it was changed. So it makes it very hard to know what happened. And the fact that your EA doesn't match your catalog is a problem. And as it is right now, even though the student is signing an EA saying you can keep $100, you actually cannot keep that $100 because the catalog says you can't. So be very, very sure, despite the fact that EA may make you think that you can have it, you can't, because the strictest rule applies and your catalog received it.
unless the, you know, they're for different periods of time. But if they're both for the same period of time, if the student has a catalog that says no fee and EA says a fee, you don't get to charge a fee.
Okay.
So is there a big deal that you still are not quite at having one?
So I'm looking at my catalog prior to this, and you guys had us remove that for some reason, because I had it in here with the catalogs that we actually hand out. The effective date of the one before that, it's in there, and for some reason during this process, we removed it, and then we put it back in again, and it didn't get put back in. So I'm looking at the ones before it, and it's in there. So during this process, somehow it got taken out because it was asked to be removed by your guys' board or by Keith, and then after rereading it again, it got asked to get put back in. So I think there's just been a mistake between me and Keith working of what we have and don't have, because there was some confusion on that portion during the process with Keith.
Are you talking about $100 was going in and out?
Yeah.
Well, since your catalog, if this is the current one, it's dated January, even if the student had gotten one dated January that said you could keep 100, the fact that you have one dated January and there's no reference to when it was revised, I still believe that that's what you have to follow. You just can't have two catalogs that have the same date and don't have the same information. It's very confusing of what's applicable. If you have not given out this catalog and you only did it for purposes of...
No, this catalog has not been given out. You guys, if this is... I'm waiting for review and approval through you guys. That we've been working on this. We have the old catalog that has that still in there. That we're trying to get this approved through you guys so we're not making any mistakes, and this process is taking a little bit longer than we expected. And now we're working on a third catalog with the Department of Ed to make their changes for them. It's been a very long year for us. We've gone through you guys, like I said, we went through our 5-year review with NACIS, and we're also going through a review with the U.S. Department of Ed with our third-party servicer. So we're trying to get one thing approved at a time, and every time we turn around, one person says to change it to this, and the other person says, no, you need to have this. It's just, it's been very complicated 6 to 8 months for us.
We can appreciate that. I think what we'd recommend is that you take away, regardless of whatever standard or that you're living into, I think you would agree that your EA and your catalog should match. That would be primary, and so that's what I would focus on, regardless of whether you take Keith's direction or another board's direction. The document should match so it doesn't create confusion for the student. That's the only reason we're bringing this forward is ultimately if a student came forward, made a complaint, and said they kept $100 and I feel I was entitled to that, and you're showing EA says you can keep 100, catalog says you can't keep 100, we would find for the complainant in this case to return the funds. That's all we're trying to clarify for you.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, no, we understand that. We're just explaining why it got taken out and put it back in.
And if, again, I do appreciate that you have a lot going on with this, and you, that's a lot coming at you, but we need to pedal to a place where we have the appropriate documentation. So I would just say if you know, there's a lot of confusion in there. I can't tell you how to run your business, but I'd be looking to get a consultant, at least for these two things, to bring it all together for you, because I know how... this is very difficult, the catalogs and enrollment agreements, and you've got to be spot on with these. So just a suggestion.
We've already done that. We're working on the one with the Department of Ed right now. We've already hired a consultant to do it all for us. You guys just don't have that copy yet because we're dealing with last year's thing. That was part of the process, was getting that. So the next one, like I said, we'll have all of the – it's everything is through a third-party person who wrote it all for us, and – making it to where it matches NACIS and the Department of Ed. But then we always have to go in and change some things so that it fits your guys' board. It's just with multiple things being accredited, and there's just some things that aren't quite there. So that's why we'll submit it once it's done with those two to you.
Since everybody is weighing in on how much we appreciate how much work you have, this is Paul Mittman, I don't appreciate it. And number one is we have six board members who all prepared for this. We have a room full of people who are sitting here waiting to do their business here. We have staff who do an excellent job working with every school that the board licenses. And if you knew in January that this work needs to be done by May, then you just need to get it done.
Period.
All right, I'm done.
I know we kind of skipped past it, too, of just going straight to the catalog and EA. I just wanted to clarify, the financials obviously in a positive at this point in time. I know you had provided previous explanation for loss associated with increased costs associated with these various renewals and costs associated with accreditation. Anything forthcoming that you would anticipate would put you back into the negative space in regards to your financials?
We don't have any large things like that for another 5 years, so we're hoping to be a little better prepared. Their prices went up quite a bit from years past. They added a couple more people they sent out, so it almost increased by, I think, almost $10,000 more than we were expecting. So now that we know their pricing stuff, be a little more prepared in the next when they come out in 5 years.
Thank you for that.
So since this catalog that we reviewed is not a valid catalog, so it's not what you're giving to the students, it's not what you submitted to the Department of Ed, I feel like we all kind of wasted our time looking at it. So I would like for you to come back, resubmit the catalog that ends up being approved by accrediting and the department, submit that to the board. And then we will send you a notice if we want you to be available on the phone in August to review it, or if staff reviews it and they're comfortable with it, then maybe we won't ask you to come back, but be prepared to possibly need to call in at our August meeting.
That's fine, and I will, I've actually already typed and added that apart while we were talking to the catalog that you guys have in hand, and changed the date effective today. So I thought it was all taken care of when I submitted it a couple weeks ago. It just must have got missed when we sent it off.
And just the fact that you can have an effective date and then there can be minor changes that occur, but you have to notate what the changes were and have a version number on the catalog. So the catalog might be effective January, but then the version might be May 23rd of 19. And then you have a document in the back that says, you know, tracks the changes. I mean, you can find typo, et cetera, so there are reasons why during the year you might make updates to the catalog, and that's fine, but you need to track them, so it shouldn't be this hard to figure out what your policies are. Okay, so I understand that we
okay.
need them for quarterly reporting, but the catalog is still in issue. Do you have anything else? All right, so as soon as it gets approved by accrediting and the Department of Ed, please submit it back to staff, and we'll speak to you in August if we need to.
Okay, hopefully it'll be done by then. It's been a two-year process already.
Please keep Mr. Blanchard up to date on where you are.
I'll send you the one that sticks the ones that we found today, and I'll send that to Keith so he knows that it's done. And then as soon as they get that back to us, I will have it over to you guys that day.
Okay, just so you know, just put it out there that if we end up getting student complaints because they can't figure out what your policies are, we will not be easy on you.
Okay.
All right. The next item on the agenda, College America.
Members of the board, at your previous meetings, you have approve the College America license renewal stipulated agreement with the stipulation that they posted a bond, they posted, and to provide to you information regarding the latest review from ACCSC. You'll note that they did, ACCSC did extend the probation, and so they Mr. Dean and Ms. Smith can provide you further information.
My name is Eric Julin. I'm the president and CEO of the Center for Excellence in Higher Education.
Cindy Smith, director, College America, Phoenix Campus.
Sure. So in September, we received a system-wide probation order from our accrediting body, ACCSC. There were a handful of items there. Some were specific to certain campuses. Other were across the applied to across our group of colleges. We have 16 ground campuses and an online college that we operate under four different brands. We have two locations in Arizona, one in Flagstaff and one in Phoenix. In December 19th, we provided a 15,000-page response to ACCSC. They reviewed that during the really first quarter of this year. First week of May, we received a response back from ACCSC that they have voted to continue the probation. Most of the items in the continuation letter were follow-up and additional questions to the items that were initially included in the September notice. There were some changes that occurred relative to our campuses in Arizona specifically. The September probation notice required us to suspend or cease enrollment in an associate degree in medical specialties program that we offered at both locations in Arizona. We, in our response, successfully made some modifications and changes to that program. The suspension from ACCSC was lifted in February of this year, and we were allowed to resume enrollment into that modified program. However, in the May letter that we received continuing the probation, ACCSC has requested that we cease enrollment in Flagstaff only on an associate degree in business program due to some consistently low outcome measures. And I can't remember if it was grad rate or employment rate for that program.
I believe it would be grad.
Grad rate,
I'm not 100% sure of that.
So we now have a response due to ACCSC on July 1st. We're in the process of going through the items that were in the May letter and preparing our analysis and response to those items. That will be considered by ACCSC at its August meeting. And they can take several actions at that point. They can remove the system-wide probation, they can continue the probation order, or if they feel necessary, they can take more aggressive action. We are, I would say, extremely confident that we will be able to answer the items and resolve the issues. My expectation will be that ACCSC will likely continue the probation order in August, because some of the items that they have in the letter relate to outcomes for some of our other locations, not in Arizona. And most of the strategies that we're implementing to improve those, which are degree programs, are really not going to show up in the results for the next couple of years. So we have until September of 2020 to fully clear the probation matter. In addition, in February, we were asked to increase the bond, which we did, to $929,000. We are also now providing, I believe it's quarterly, data information to the state, which was a requirement of the stipulation agreement on student ledgers and names and rosters. And then there were some other items that were raised in February relative to issues with our catalog and our enrollment agreement. We made modifications to both of those pursuant to the comments and feedback from the board and submitted those to the staff on April 25th. So I believe you have all of that information. Pause there.
I had one question. The last board meeting, I remember making a comment regarding your commercials that were running on TV that implied that there was no general education requirements in your programs, and I had asked you guys to go back and review those commercials and address that. Did you do that?
We're no longer running those commercials. Those were kind of a person in the street where we were asking people questions, and so some of the comments from these random people, I think, is what you had concern with, and we've ceased that campaign.
What's your school population, though?
Which location?
Phoenix, Flagstaff.
What is the population of the Phoenix campus? Right around 300.
And I think Flagstaff is probably just under 100.
Mm-hmm. Is it the same program, the one that you being asked to stop enrolling for at Flagstaff? Is this structurally the same program as the one at Phoenix?
It is. It's identical.
Have you tried to investigate why it's, I assume it's being successful at Phoenix, it's not being successful at Flagstaff?
The Phoenix campus, I believe, has met the outcome measures, whereas the Flagstaff campus hasn't. We're in the process of looking at that right now, specifically relative to the Flagstaff campus. We've implemented several measures across the board. Probably the most significant change that we did across all of our institutions was moving the associate degree in business program to a new model where students are only taking one course per module. A module for us is a four-week period of time. We just rolled that out last fall, and so far we're seeing significant improvement in those students through the first two, three mods, which historically has been one of the highest inflection points as far as dropout rates, the first three or four mods that they're in school. And what we were finding in the data was that in the first two or three mods under the old program design, students were in those second or third mod having to take two classes per four-week module rather than just one, and there seemed to be a much higher dropout rate, less retention during that period. So with the changes we made, we're seeing improvements, but again, the cohort that is now enrolling and pursuing through that program with that change, we won't be reporting on that to ACCSC until three cohorts in the future because of the way they report on their cohort time period.
Is that changing the overall plan length of the program, of how long it takes to pull that student? It's just a change in schedule at the initial?
No, it's still, I think it still ended up being a 20-month program. There was a slight change in some of the overall credits, but I think it was, I don't think it was a substantial change. It was four or five credits.
Correct. It's still a 20-month program.
Is that a fairly low attended program? I mean, low enrollment into that program?
Well, I mean, Flagstaff is not a large population to begin with. And Flagstaff, I believe, historically really has only run two programs, which was the associate degree in medical specialties, which is now an associate degree in medical assisting, you know, very specific to just medical assisting, and then their business program. So now Flagstaff really just has the one program since we've ceased enrollment 2 weeks ago in the business program.
How many would you have anticipated were in that program at that time?
I honestly can't answer that. I don't know what the current enrollment is at Flag in just that program. I could get you that information.
I didn't know if it was like north of 100 or south.
No, the total population of the school rarely has exceeded 100. So there's...
You're talking maybe 15, 20?
Correct.
And those, when you lose one, it has a big impact.
Huge impact. We're dealing with low numbers in the Flagstaff campus.
Okay.
The program that they're in, is it also offered in the online?
Our online university, which is Independence University, does offer that same program. But we've also, in the May letter from ACCSC, we're required to suspend enrollment in that program, the Associate Degree in Business at Independence University as well. So we've done that.
So that program is then only being taught in Phoenix?
No. So we have 16 ground campuses and one online. The suspension of the associate degree in business only applied to our online college, Independence University, and our ground campus in Flagstaff. So a lot of our other ground campuses are still offering that program, such as Phoenix.
It's not just Phoenix, there are other schools that are offering it as well.
Correct.
Is your program designed so that you assume your students are working adults? Are they working during the day and taking night, or...
Our ground campuses, most of our ground campuses will have day schedules and night schedules. So you'll have populations enrolled in both day and night.
So when you set up a schedule such that there are two courses taken concurrently online and you're assuming that they have other lives like working or something else, do you set academic standards as far as what GPA, for example, is required in order to take two at a time, or are you just setting that up in the schedule and everybody does that thing? You know what I'm saying? It's like when you
I'm
talk
not,
about
because,
the
I mean, in most, well, the for with respect to the business program, that was revised to where a student will not be taking two classes during a four-week module any longer. Some of our other programs, that still can happen periodically. It depends how the student is moving through in their schedule. So there will be, for instance, in an associate degree 20-month program, there will be some modules where they take two courses rather than one.
And in those cases, do you set GPA requirements for the people that can do that thing so that you know that they're going to be successful versus requiring everyone to do that who may not be have the ability to?
I think I understand your question. So we do have overall for every single one of our programs, all students have to maintain satisfactory academic progress.
Right.
Now that has a GPA requirement, and it also has a course completion requirement. There is not a specific requirement that says when you take two courses per module, you have some different standard other than the satisfactory academic progress standard. However, if a student wants to move through the program faster, which we would call a fast track, where they want to say, I want to take every single module, I want to take two courses if I can, we then do have a standard that they have to maintain to get into the fast track, which I think is a
3.0.
I guess one thing, based on my experience, I would say is you might want to look at setting an expectation for a GPA for anyone who wants to take two courses at once, because it could have contributed to what you're experiencing in that the requirements of 2 4-week courses at the same time is a lot. And if a
Correct.
Student is very close, they might be meeting SAP. They could have a 2.25 or a 2.5, and the minute they take two at a time with potentially 6 credits, can significantly impact their ability to be successful. So
I agree. And one of the strategies we have in place is to go systematically through all of our program inventories, and we're making modifications to try to get them all where a student is only taking one per 4-week module.
Unless they say
to come to us and say, I want to take more.
I think that's perfectly
Yeah, and then you have a bar they have to get over to do that. Yeah, what they've told us in their letter is our July response will be considered at their August meeting. I'm not sure when in August their meeting is, and then typically it's a few months after that we receive a response. So this last cycle, our response from December was considered in February. We received communication in May.
So October, we probably...
I think that would probably
be... our October meeting.
letters and notices from presidents that other states that cause problems to report them to the board, and they'll let you know if they do anything else. Otherwise, we'll see them in October.
Sure. Yeah, we'll update you on any developments.
Thank you.
Next item on the Cordova Institute, teach out of all 4 campuses.
Hello, my name is Beth Hepler. I'm here for Cordova.
Okay, Madam Chair, if Mr. Mountain can give you an update on the Canadian teach out.
Yeah. So, thank you, Madam Chair. The teach out is going. We did run into a glitch this last week with, and I'm confident that the representatives from Cordova can talk about that the school was locked down on Monday. They were locked out of the campus. I happened to be down in Tucson on an accreditation visit, and I attended the campus, looked at it, and they were certainly locked out. At that time, I was also there when the it was either an attorney or someone provided the rent check to the management company and then reopened the facility. So there was no education going on Monday of this week. Outside of that, we've been working with the group to make sure that we've acquiring the transcripts and all of the student records from the various campuses that we'll be closing. I believe, and I'm confident that the representatives can talk more about the specific date, but we have June 20th as a target date for completion of the teach-out process with the students. I know that we have had students go and attend other schools. They have transferred. They've been effectively transferring to other institutions. Again, I also had the opportunity on Monday to talk to some of the transferred students from Corteva over to another institution in Tucson, and that went quite well. The students are happy that they've moved over, sad to not be able to complete their education at Corteva, but excited that they can continue their education in another institution. And I know that the Corteva has also reached out. I would like an update from the school, reached out to Parchment locally here in Arizona to look at putting their records into that particular format. And I know that there's a number of institutions that were prior to Corteva ownership that the Corteva has transcripts on that go all the way back through paper records and microfiche that we would be very interested in hearing an update from the school as well.
Hello, my name is Beth Hepler. I'm here to represent Corteva Institute.
Yes, go ahead and feel free to give us provide an update to the board.
Thank you very much. Yes, as you are aware, Corteva has made the difficult decision to close all Corteva Institutes located in Arizona. Originally, our plan was to close only the Tempe location. At that time, we were being approached by several buyers, and it was our goal to basically sell our schools to another company. Unfortunately, the deal didn't work out as planned, and we made the decision, the circumstances changed. And on April 10, 2019, the decision was made to close all four locations. As soon as the decision was made, our accreditors and the Board of Cosmetology, as applicable, were notified of our decision. Any students who were scheduled to start school in April, our decision was made on April the 10th, any students who started the week or so, the few days before the April 10th, were canceled, and they were given a full refund of all monies paid to the schools. The remaining students were given the following options. Students who were scheduled to graduate on or before June 9th could stay and complete their education just as scheduled. We had a large number of students who are matriculating or were matriculating then who were scheduled to graduate in about the next 2 weeks. Students who were scheduled to graduate in August could expedite their training. Our closeout date goals are as followed: for the Phoenix location, June 9th, for Tucson, June 18th, and for June 23 for Scottsdale. These dates were chosen to allow as many graduates as possible to complete their programs without compromising the integrity of their program. Additionally, any students who wanted to could choose and transfer to another school on their own. Students who chose this option were reminded that a drop calculation would be completed and students would be charged for their time at Corteva. They were also reminded that Corteva would make every effort to provide whatever documents needed, such as proof of accreditation, et cetera. And we worked with a number of partners in our surrounding areas to work through this process to help students get transferred as easily as possible. And I'm glad to hear that it's, for the most part, working out pretty well. Students were also given the option to withdraw and receive a full refund. Students interested in transferring, as I mentioned, we attempted to the extent possible to work it out so that there were no additional costs to students. And again, we also, and the board may be aware of this, we also explored several teach-out possibilities, change of ownership possibilities, and those other types of things with other nearby schools. Unfortunately, formal teach-out agreements could not be reached, kind of a traditional, as we think of as a teach-out. But again, we're continuing to work with schools in our area about any possibilities, potentially assuming our leases or whatever, to the extent possible under the regulations. Again, for students who were unable or unwilling to transfer, full refunds were made. All refunds have been processed already for the Tempe campus and are in the process or have been processed for the Scottsdale, Phoenix, and Tucson campuses. To date, close to $400,000 has been paid back to students. Although a bond is in place to protect our students, we do not intend to rely on the bond to make student refunds. The company is paying for refunds or returning funds as applicable. The parent company does have the means to do this, and we're working very hard to take care of our students. Again, we are in the process of working with state staff to ensure that all student records are turned over to the board in an organized and complete manner in accordance with state regulations. In addition, we are working with Parchment Services, which, as I think everybody knows, is a professional records slash transcript maintenance company. We are in possession of records going back many years, going back to paper records, microfilm, microfiche for some of our previous owners of our campuses. We are aware that we're responsible for those records as well, and we are in the process of digitizing them and making sure that they are stored and maintained in perpetuity. As far as our employees, all of our campus directors and some key instructional staff members are given retention bonuses to stay on board to support our remaining matriculating students to close out the schools in an organized fashion. Remaining employees will receive a severance based on their position with the company. Additionally, corporate staff are still involved and they're assisting the schools through the closeout. Post-closure, corporate staff will assist with managing final closeout audits, provide documents to regulators, and support students for at least 90 days post-closure with career services assistance. Third-party companies moving forward into next year will make sure that all employees receive tax forms and students receive their 1098-Ts. So that is kind of my formal summary. And I think as Kevin mentioned earlier, we did have a little unexpected issue earlier this week. We, our landlords know that, I guess they kind of know that we are exploring options with other schools in the area. And I think that landlords have gotten kind of word that our schools are in the process of closing. Our landlord in Tucson, as I understand it, I have a copy I sent it to Terry earlier in the week. We cut a check on May 2nd to pay the rent. For reasons that are unknown to us, they did not either receive the check or they chose not to open it, or there was a shipping delay or something happened. And unfortunately, our students came to school on Monday morning to find our doors chained shut, which was obviously very upsetting to our students and our staff. You know, people had personal belongings and everything else in the campus. As soon as our staff were aware of the situation, we immediately got on the phone with our legal counsel, who got on the phone with the legal counsel of our landlord. They immediately wired a check in the full amount of May's rent, June's rent, and applicable late fees, no questions asked, to the landlord in Tucson. Everything was, chains were removed, everything was fine. We are paid through the end of the month. We have verified with all of our other locations that there are no further issues with rents or anything else. It was very unfortunate. We're very sorry it happened. We know that it was very, very upsetting to our students to come to school and see that, but we did take swift action. Only one day of classes were interrupted for our students, and our students, of course, were giving them the opportunity to make up that work, as you know, at various times and places, so to impact our students no further. And let me know if you have questions or further concerns.
Are you keeping count of how many students are still with you and how many are transferring and where?
Yes, we have, and I can actually send that to the board. I don't have that information right in front of me, but we do have lists of all of our students, all of our students who opted to get a full refund, all of our students who decided to transfer with our assistance, when and where they went, what their status is. I can send the board, I can send you all the list of whatever you need to know as far as our matriculating students, where they are, and what their plan is.
That would be great.
I will do that.
Anything else?
Just to, Beth, this is Kevin, to double check on the Parchment relationship. So I did meet with them a couple of weeks ago regarding you.
Yes.
They had mentioned that they are working with you. Is that... that contract that you're working with them, that's going to continue to come to fruition, correct? Do I need to worry about this in another couple of weeks that all those old records that are in boxes someplace then become?
No, we are digitizing. And, you know, Kevin, I'd be happy to chat with you further about it in the terms of our contract with Parchment and everything else. I believe, if I remember correctly, we need to send records to your offices digitally as well as to Parchment. Is that correct?
Correct. The information that I provided you shows we mirror that of the Parchment.
Of the Parchment, yes. I remember that email, yes, for sure. And, yes, we You do not need to worry, and I can send you some updates kind of as we go along. I believe our legal counsel was looking at the agreement with Parchment a little bit further, and you know how that goes. It sometimes takes a few days to get through that, but I can kind of keep you abreast, even on a weekly basis, of where we are, what numbers we're looking at, what's been digitized, what's in process. I'm happy to stay in communication with you. We understand the importance of maintaining our records.
Great. Thank you. That'd be helpful.
And if you please send the list of the disposition of the students to Kevin as well, so we could...
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so keep Mr. Mountain up to date on how things are going and what the flow of the students are as you get them transitioned out, and just work directly with him, and if we need you to come back before the board, he will notify you.
Thank you very much.
The next item on the agenda is the Unmanned Vehicle University, an update on EAP.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. At your January 2019 meeting, the board approved the provisional degree-granting license for unmanned vehicle under stipulated agreement for probation for 1 year to maintain 136-245 bond, to continue to provide electronic copies of student records on a quarterly basis, and to provide updates on DEAC, as well as if they were given a negative report or determination by DEAC after the revised report, that they agreed to surrender the license. They did sign that agreement on January 31st. I believe it was in February, DEAC conducted their on-site visit, and on April 11th, 2019, DEAC notified UVU that they were deemed ready to proceed through the accreditation process. And Mr. Miner is here and can provide you with further updates and what the next steps will be.
John Miner, Provost.
I'm Josh Raitzer, Student Services.
Does
that make sense? Sure. So I believe we've complied with all of the conditions that were set forth. And Kevin, I believe you received everything electronically that you needed from us. And we had a successful meeting in February with DEAC, and we were told verbally that we were ready to proceed to the on-site evaluation. In April, about a month and a half after the meeting, we received the actual report and an official letter just confirming what they had told us verbally. We're in the process of submitting our curriculum for review and the educational offerings report. Those are due to DEAC on June the 3rd. Once they receive those, then they will schedule an on-site visit with us. My understanding is that it will probably be sometime in the fall. And they don't expect the results of our on-site visit to meet the January 2024. It will more likely meet the July 2024. So we're looking forward to it. We're still fully committed to accreditation. We believe the curriculum review will go well because we think that's our strongest point.
A lot of work.
Yeah. It's been a process. And we appreciate all of the feedback that we've gotten because it's helped us improve.
How long do you think it will take to complete the DEAC of the evaluation?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last
one. I said, how long do you anticipate it's going to take to go through this DEAC process and get down to it? Do you have any idea on the time frame?
We hope to be accredited July of 2020.
2020.
When the board meets in year. July. Yes.
I'm just curious, will they have difficulty finding someone to review the curriculum?
They have mentioned that they may need to ask us for some advice on where they could send certain parts of the curriculum which are highly specialized.
So, that would be a definite challenge, as the program is so unique.
They've mentioned that to us a couple of times, and we're...
That's probably why it's kicked all the way back to July of 2020, is my assumption.
Probably so. I would imagine so.
It must make it difficult also if you have an instructor who leaves.
Well, within the community, it is a small community, but we do have backup instructors for every course.
That's good. Good to hear that.
I'm curious about that for James. Is she returning anytime soon?
I'm not sure exactly what her time to return is. I would say it'll probably be at least 3 or 4 more months because she's just having too much fun with her baby.
She'll be back in plenty of time before you have the next on-site.
I'll just say congratulations.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Congratulations to you and to her.
We all appreciate that very much.
I'm just curious, can I just ask, have other institutions in other states started this similar curriculum? I mean, drones are a big thing now.
Well, Embry-Riddle does have a couple of programs now. They do. They're similar to ours, but not exactly the same. And there's other schools that have drone programs as well. The large universities, Kansas State has a program. Virginia Tech has a program. There's probably a dozen campuses in the U.S. that have specific drone programs. And then there's a lot of training that's popping up that is just being taught by people putting courses together because they're experts in flying drones and they know the FAA regulations and they're teaching groups of people. But we like where we're positioned in the market right now.
Well, it probably sounds almost like nothing's going to change, and then you renew in January.
Right.
I'd say a renewal. Very little is going to change in the meantime.
Can you handle going that long without having to come here?
We can make that work.
All right, so make that renewal packet be awesome, if you please.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda, the regular degree grant license renewal for Arizona Christian University.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, at your May 2018 meeting, the State Board approved the license renewal by stipulated agreement for Arizona Christian University. They maintain the $300,000 surety bond and to provide electronic student records on a quarterly basis. ACU was also required to submit a notice report to HLC on February and hosted in 2018 and hosted a focus visit in March 2018. The team report on page 18 stated that evidence demonstrated that HLC follow-up recommended and request a follow-up report in June of 2019. The HLC letter, Ms. Sweeney indicated that the HLC Commission will review all reports and responses from the institution to remove notice at the November meeting. In November of 2018, HLC did remove ACU from on notice, requiring an interim report due June 30th regarding core components 3C, 5A, and 5C. ACU is now seeking renewal of the 2019 regular degree granting license. And here representing the institution is Dr. Steve Adamson and
Timothy Fisher.
Timothy Fisher, CFO. And your board member lead is Dr. Mittman.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Would you like to make a statement?
Sure.
Gentlemen?
Sure. Steve Adamson, Provost and Chief Operating Officer. Give you some updates of some things that have been happening at the university that may or not have been in the the annual submission. For the second year in a row, the school was ranked by the U.S. News and World Report as a best college in the West region. Recently, a graduation class that we just finished at the first of this year, we've got out of 99 students, we have about a half a dozen already going on to grad school. One is ASU Law, Harvard Law, Duke Divinity, and Midwestern Medical School. In the fall, we're going to be launching a computer programming, blockchain, cybersecurity curriculum that we are doing in cooperation with Arizona State University West as a concurrently enrolled program. As Stanfield mentioned, last November we were removed from notice by the HLC. From a residential component, we had 4 years in a row of record enrollment, reaching the point where our campus road cactus was at full capacity. And November 14th, we completed a land swap with Arizona State University and have now, we're in the process of moving our staff over, and so now Arizona Christian University is the owner of the 68-acre parcel in Glendale, the former campus of the Thunderbird School of Global Management, and we're in the process of moving all of our staff now, last week and this week, and the students will arrive in the fall to begin the instruction there. We recently had a clean, unqualified opinion in our last audit. Have a Department of Ed composite score above 1.5. We're in the process either today or tomorrow of completing a financing instrument for some excess property we have on Cave Creek. And we had a fundraising event in March where we secured pledges in excess of $5 million. And so significant increases and improvements. And so it was a very good year for us. And so we're happy to answer any questions you have.
Great. Well, thank you very much. A couple of questions. I think you have an interim report back to the HLC next month.
June 30th, correct.
Right. On the those three criteria, 3C, 5A, and 5C. And where is that at?
The report is probably almost finished. It's an update of where we are with respect to integrating budgeting and a five-year planning cycle. That's one aspect that they wanted updates on. Another is the size of our faculty staff for teaching instruction, and so they wanted to just see our plan for increasing faculty with our increased enrollment. And those are the main items, and so we have a full-up report. And actually, it probably ends up being 10 pages, and it was an update. That probably will be the last thing we do with them. Our 10-year reaffirmation is 2021, and so that's probably the next time we'll see the Higher Learning Commission with a full-up assurance.
Okay. And do we have unaudited financials? Because the last financial statements we have are the audit from last June 30th. Do you receive any?
June 30th of last year?
Yeah, 2018. I didn't see unaudited financials.
Because your fiscal year ends June, right?
Right.
Fiscal year ends June.
We would not have another one.
Not unaudited. We don't get unaudited when coming up for renewal. Okay. All right, so going back to the audit, if you could walk me through, and I forgot your name.
Sure.
Your
name?
Tim Fisher. You're the CFO. Okay. All right, so going through the financial statements. So, for starters, could you tell us about the gift of online curriculum, the valuation, and how that's being used and how that is being expensed or depreciated, and what is it turned into?
Sure. We received this in 2015, and under generally accepted accounting principles, all gifted assets must be recorded And so we set this up as a software, if you will. There isn't very much written about JAP or curriculum, so we classified it as a software piece. We had it independently valued at that time, and so that entire asset was set up at the time. It's an anonymous donor that came to us. It has been audited for the last 3 years in a row. We have a method of amortization, and it's based upon enrollment and based upon the use of the curriculum. We will amortize that of those courses that are actively being used, and then if we judge those courses, some of those courses to no longer be applicable, we will write those courses off entirely. So we continually examine the list of curriculum. We continuously update it as needed, and if we don't offer those courses or we feel that it's no longer an asset of ours like that would require, we would write that off. That's exactly what we're doing.
So a lot of times I'm always interested to learn new things. So this is kind of new. So it's not a learning management system. It's not the online delivery, because I know you contracted, I can't remember, in 2017 with another group for that. So this is actual curriculum for X number of courses. So in other words, one or a group of faculty or instructors gifted to the university, whatever, biology 101, or biblical studies 202, et cetera, as complete course descriptions. Or what? Because I assume somebody still has to teach the course, and it predated when you were approved for distance learning. I'm just trying to understand it because it kind of...
It is intriguing, yes. These courses were ready-to-use courses that we transferred from the donor's learning management system into our learning management system. And it had all the course content that any other curriculum that you would have if you were to purchase it off the shelf, a complete syllabi.
So can you give us, without obviously naming the anonymous donor, but can you tell us, like, give me an example of a course that is part of the path?
Well,
I mean...
All realms.
Yes.
Anyone that's kind of...
It's going to be an English 101. It's going to be an upper division business ethics. Most of it was in a biblical studies component, and it was gifted to enable us from a kind donor to get a head start under the assumption we would soon be approved by the Higher Learning Commission, and then rather to have to incur the internal expense of developing the curriculum that was from a donor that had a similar approach that we had, a similar mindset, and they had already spent the investment of building the curriculum for their own uses, and were happy to let us use it as well.
So we have gone through the process of tailoring it exactly to our school, changing the name, changing some of the content, and so we've had subject matter experts on our own staff. They've gone through and modified it, updated it, take some of the changes in names or make it more applicable to exactly what we do. But the cost to put a new course on the books is between $5,000 and $15,000 a course. And so this was a great head start for us as we have received all the approvals to offer online education. This gives us a head start, both in timing and also in cost that would be incurred in order to get these courses out. And we're using those courses.
If my math is right, so you gifted 400 courses?
Yes. I don't have the exact number, but it's quite a few.
Right, because it was valued at over $5 million.
Yes. We had an independent study. The prior auditors, we conferred with them, and also are the ones that we have right now, and went through the entire process, and everybody was satisfied with the manner in which it was done.
How did your faculty feel about that? So instead of the development of the courses being done by the faculty, the institution, 400 courses is quite a lot. How did they accept that?
The faith component of where the curriculum came from, it matches up with ours, and it's the relationship and the friendship between us and them is very close. And as you can tell probably from the audit, the depreciation schedule is would increase as we begin to use more courses. And as Mr. Fisher mentioned, as time progresses and as information in particular fields change, we may discover that some courses are no longer currently applicable, and then we would have to, in some of those in out years, do accelerated depreciations. But the short answer, your faculty was aware of all of these. They were actually involved in reviewing and seeing what the curriculum was before it came over.
And so years ago, you used to have someone who was doing a lot of the online business management, if you will, and now is that agreement that you had previously with another entity that's separated, as I remember, and you're doing that all in-house by yourself. What is your online enrollment for the institution now?
The online enrollment for the institution now is around 100, and it was a slower start because we had to start from scratch with the partner in 2017 that closed up operations, and so we spent all of the remainder of 17 and the first half of 18 getting the curriculum up into our LMS, and then the fall was the first time we really began offering the full-up curriculum. So we've got 1 year under our belt. And
how many staff do you have dedicated to running online operations?
Let me see. 7 from what I would consider the support structure, verifying the integrity of the faculty instruction, monitoring performance reports, working with the students in a retention mode, student nurturing, student orientation, faculty training. And then other components then outside of that would be on the recruiting lead generation, which is more of a dollar spend as opposed to the number of people. And then you've got the faculty or adjuncts teaching, but in-house running the infrastructure is 7 right now.
All have previous online experience?
Yes, they do.
Who's going to make a smarty comment that you could have characterize this as manna from heaven.
Yes.
For your faculty.
It's quite a gift.
Yes. Very good. Very appropriate.
So, for the with the real estate swap, you also have recorded a $1.1 million in-kind gift for athletic, to create an athletic field or athletic facility. Will you still be able to do that in the new facility, or? And if not, what are you going to do with the $1.1 million?
Yes, that grant moves with us to the new location. And so actually we're very close to probably putting it down. We had some work to do with the new campus to move some utilities that were not dug deep enough and to get things ready. And so
okay. But you'll be able to use it.
We'll be able to use it. And okay. We'll probably be going in this fall.
Okay. In your audit, I don't have it in front of me, but on page 11, your fundraising costs are pretty high for the amount that you're generating, and I'm just wondering why that's the case. And I know that, you know, GuideStar, Charity Watchdog, this, that, and the other thing, everybody looks at it. What goes into that?
But we have been building fundraising strategies, and sometimes you have to invest money in order to build those strategies, and we have instituted what's called the annual award, which is a very expensive process. It takes a lot of cost to get that set up. For the last 2 years in a row, we have had what's called the President's Summit, where we invite guests from all over the country to come in and let them listen to what we have to offer. That's a very expensive program. We've had two successful summits, and when we do this again, it's going to be a lot more efficient, and it's going to be a whole lot more people. Our advisors with this, and this is from an independent party, said it takes up to 3, maybe 4 years in order to get a momentum built for annual fundraising events, and that's a lot of those costs have gone into that.
Okay. I was just wondering, because I know in the audits that I've been through, sometimes we go back and forth with the auditors about how they're characterizing certain expenditures, which may or may not, you know, be actual fundraising expenses. I'm not sure if the summit has other, you know, purposes or benefits for the institution, if there's an educational component to it. That may be a way to kind of push back so that it's more either support or there's some other way to characterize it in your statement.
That is a very good point. Thank you.
Okay, now, can you pull up the audit? Because I need to, this part I read it like 4 times and I didn't really understand it. If you can go to note 7 on page 14, there's an uncollateralized loan to an individual bearing 5% interest due 2021. Monthly interest payments of $11,563 beginning in January 17th. And the annual maturity is $1.88 million. So I believe it's a related party, and so if you could kind of walk us through what that refers to, that would be great.
This was a loan made by a former board member. It is no longer a board member, and this was in order for us to pay off the existing IDA bond that we've had on the Cactus campus. That bond had to be paid in full, and so we worked with this individual, again, not on the board, to assist us, and he has funded this. In the meantime, we're working with the IDA on the bond and other investment opportunities in order to have that bond refinanced in a way that it's best in the best interest of the school. So this was an important step as we were able to get this land exchange affected, get the new bond paid off, and the new financing taken care of.
The transaction with the individual predates the real estate transaction by a couple of years, right? And so that was a project that you were working on?
The prior owner of the bond, which was Chase Bank, had asked that we find a new investor, and that was done in 2016 and 17. And this individual said he'll take care of the financing and purchase the bond away from Chase and under the similar terms and conditions and actually at a rate that is market-driven, and that's the way it should be. And we continue to pay this individual in accordance, really the same bond terms and conditions of what we have with Chase Bank. And as we get this new transaction from the exchange refinanced through IDA, then different investors will be in place.
So, because there's two notes. Note 7 is the transaction that we're talking about, right? And then note 8 is the bonds payable. Are those the same, are they both referring to the same tranche of funding?
It is the same investor or the same lender, and the 2.7 was folded into the 8.1 as to one secured mortgage transaction on the Glendale property.
Okay. So, so basically, the 2019 $508,000 is equivalent to what you were paying for the bond payments or master trust or whatever you had in place for the IDA.
Correct.
Now you're just paying it to an individual.
Correct.
Right. And I think just for the board, I believe it's about the calculation that you had, it's like 2.15% interest based on the floating rate that you had, the 1% plus half of LIBOR. So that, I mean, that's a good thing. So, I mean, I think that's good. And then, so all of these notes payable, note 7, the uncollateralized loan to an individual, bearing 5% interest. It reads odd because it reads as that you have an uncollateralized help. So you have an uncollateralized loan from an individual? So it's not a loan that was made to an individual?
No, this is these are loans made to us by individuals.
Okay. And are these, in note 7, are these all the same individual?
No.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, right? But there's the 2.75, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's 100,000, 75,000, 10,000. And then again, on the next page, $2.7 million. Is that like a typo?
It's a typo.
Okay, good. So not a second batch
that's
like
reissued.
That.
That's a great find. These statements were red and red and double red and triple red, and none of us picked it up. So the 2.775 all the on page 15, going down to the 500,000 at the bottom of that page, that is
the duplicate.
They're duplicate.
Right. But then. It picks up again on page 16.
Yep.
So that's all an individual. So these are different individuals.
Yes.
Right. And then they're all related parties. Right. Because there's an asterisk that says indicates related parties. And so you shed a little bit of light on, like, if not the name of the parties, like, you know, the auditors felt that they're related in what way?
Yeah,
by marriage, family, employment?
These are past board members, friends of the university, and under the definition of with GAAP, an unrelated party, we include it that way. There are different definitions of related party transactions. This is one that we disclose that these are friends of the university that had prior board seats, and they have since retired and continue to be friends of the university.
Are they? Do they have an official designation, like an emeritus trustee? So, I mean, just out of curiosity, it would seem that given the problem with the HLC with the Firestorm Future Fund, that, you know, if I were reading this, that would be the first thing that I would think of, which are related parties.
These,
so I'm just wondering, why would they be?
They.
Why would you want to be an asterisk next to them?
They. The Firestorm transaction was because we had existing board members part of that. So we took action immediately. And so these are people that have had a past relationship and are independent accountants judged that that was close enough to a related party under GAAP that they that we needed to disclose it in that way. They are not they have no ties other than a friendship to the university.
They don't serve on the board of trustees. They don't serve on an advisory council.
Nothing.
And they're not current employees.
They are not current.
Okay. I mean, I would push. I mean, the audit is the audit, but since you're going to have another one coming up, I would push really hard to get rid of that.
We may.
They're not, assuming that they're not, I mean, I trust what you're saying. Okay. So, the amounts due for these are, it doesn't look like payments have been made because the totals are the same 2017 and 2018. So is there a payment schedule for those that is either deferring any payments to some future date, so to the time when you expect to refinance the bonds or have a new set of bonds issued?
The respective lenders agree to have interest only, including the very large debts. We make monthly interest payments. It does not call for any payments until, I believe, 2021. And that by that time we will have these notes all the biggest ones, they will be refinanced, and then we will be under the bond indenture that we agreed to when we refinance these transactions.
Okay.
All interest is paid on monthly basis.
Okay, and the interest is what you would just what's described here as the 1% plus liability divided by 25 for all of it.
Just for those big ones, the 2.775 and 8.119, those are a part of the LIBOR converted into a taxable debt.
Okay, and your goal is to have new bonds issued when?
By September.
This
we're in the process of doing that right now.
So you're going to the IDA, and then you're going to have another master trust venture and the assets. Okay. And
it's a lengthy process.
I guess the question that I would have is, could that be wrapped up by September, given the fact that you're not going to have audited statements probably during this time period, like because the fiscal year ends June 30th.
Well, we have,
and you showed a loss last year, right? So I'm just wondering, from a positioning standpoint, first of all, I guess the first question is, where is the university this year in terms of finances from a P&L or income statement standpoint?
We have a operating surplus so far for the first three quarters of the year of $2.4 million.
Okay.
And so we as Dr. Adamson had said that we've had a good year. And we anticipate that we will have a surplus by the end of this year. We're working with an investment banker to assist us with the bonds. And a portion of the bonds will be tax exempt to the extent that they will qualify as tax exempt dollars, and a portion will be taxable. And so we are working on a timetable with them, and the timetable target is the end of September. It could be extended extended beyond that.
Right.
The investment banker is confident that the audit will not have a bearing on being able to merchandise those loans, and that they will not wait for the audited financials to come out based upon our interim statements and based upon the historical financials that we have. If we fund in September or fund in October and the audit's not done until the end of October, November, it is the belief of the investment company that this transaction will be affected with or without the audit.
Okay. And how big a bond package are you going for?
We don't know that yet, but I would anticipate that it would be in the neighborhood of about $15 million. And the school is debt adverse, if you will. Even though we have a lot of individual small debts, we don't want to borrow anything more than what we really have to do. And then we will start paying down those bonds and try to get them paid as quickly as the bond indenture will allow us to do.
Okay. It's pretty interesting.
Oh, it is.
Bunch of notes. I would say, given that, and I assume that your composite score is going to be significantly higher this year than the 1.53 last year. I don't know if you can calculate that out. Kind of projected what it would be, I'm sure it would be over 2.
We have calculated the score based upon where we see the bottom line surplus to be. Then we will be recording the exchange transaction that will cause a big shift in our net assets because of the value of that property. We have to value the New Glendale property at its appraised value, and then we will remove the Cactus property away from our balance sheet. But all things considered, our composite score will be north of 2 in a pretty positive way. But all that, we're working with our accountants next week to work with us to get this transaction closed. It's quite complicated. This is a transaction that is very common anywhere in the country when it comes to a school moving in such an extraordinary way that Dr. Adamson just referred. So we will be recording this transaction before the end of June to reflect the net asset gain that we will have with this new valuable plot of land and building.
Probably increase the appraisal, right?
Well, the appraised
of the property, it's significantly larger, more facilities, right?
Yeah. The land is appraised to be equal between the two properties. The buildings that have been appraised to be quite a bit higher. And so we have a lot of buildings, a lot of square footage that we will be recording the assets of those and get that on the books and then start writing it off just like we do any other asset.
Okay. Well, it's your congratulations on a good year on the swap and on some of this. I guess, you know, it's, I'm not sure that this is exactly spot on, but since you're taking on a bigger property that will depreciate more, I know that you got a couple $100,000 towards maintenance and all of that as part of the swap. The risk averse, the debt aversion, on the one hand, I'm pretty sure that like the composite score is very liquid based and really, you know, any long-term debt is not is actually beneficial from the composite score, but it's your school.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think most schools would go for as big a bond as you can afford to pay off because it'll help, you know, portions of it would help pay for some of the ongoing maintenance and depreciation costs. But
we're in our budget cycle right now, and so all these things that you just properly brought up are things that are quite on our minds, and we have it covered. And it's we anticipate another surplus this next year, the next fiscal year, even with the increase square footage and costs that we have. Our enrollment numbers are quite positive as to where we want it to be, and we are realizing that today.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair, do you have others?
I can't imagine.
Your enrollment agreement? You start out the very first page of the enrollment agreement. You're saying, hey, if you don't pay 100% before 14 days, you're in trouble. You haven't yet said what program they're in, how much they're being charged, nothing. You're just right off the bat telling them that they need to pay 14 days before they start. So just from a consumer perspective, sure. It's not very valid. And I don't understand why you don't, like, right at the top, have anything saying what they're enrolling in and how much they're being charged. Because your very next paragraph says, I'm acknowledging this invoice. How can your EA be an invoice? You're not even telling them how much they're charging, so how can someone acknowledge an invoice that has no dollar value attached to it? But I just think that's odd.
Did you get the updated version of the enrollment agreement?
It was on the...
It's an updated one that has the student ID and the program up on the top. So you may not...
Oh, it does have the program, but it doesn't have the dollars, sorry.
Okay.
So, yeah, the program doesn't say how much.
Sure, and this is something that's part of a transition from a paper system to an online enrollment agreement. And so the student sees their bill. And so this is a PDF capture of the enrollment agreement that comes following what they see when they register for classes and what the bills are. So it's not all
self-contained. Going forward, maybe do a sample student or something, because what I'm looking at doesn't make any sense.
It almost seems like they've combined two things. It almost seems like they combined it, like what a typical enrollment agreement would be and a registration form as far as like a term is considered. So like traditional students will typically complete a registration form to sign up for certain classes.
Right.
It kind of looks like you guys are trying to combine those two things together, and I think what she's cautioning you against is perhaps maybe not doing that.
That would be very helpful, yeah.
Or it could be that the version of students looking at it makes more sense, but, you know, me looking at it, and I'm on the complaint committee, so like I'm always looking for things people are going to complain about and come in, and I have to read volumes of them complaining about it, and you have to come and get volumes explaining why they're wrong. And if I were a consumer, I would look at this and, first of all, not feel like you really wanted me there, because the first thing you're doing is threatening me to pay something which I don't know what it is. But also, interestingly, in your catalog, you say they have to pay 7 days in advance for the enrollment agreement or whatever it is. It says you have to pay 14 days in advance. So pick one.
Right.
And then you are not allowed to charge a fee to Title IV financial aid people for not being able to pay prior to the start of the term or even at the start of the term. And you don't have any caveat in there that says unless other arrangements have been made, and you need to do that because this says that you're going to start charging them. It doesn't say when. I don't know whether you're charging them starting 14 days in advance of the term, 7 days in advance of the term, or when the term starts. But you're saying you're going to charge them a fee, and you're telling them if it's not paid by the 7 or 14 days in advance, they have to set up a payment plan. So does that mean that Title IV students that are getting 100% paid by Title IV, do they need to sign a payment plan saying there are no monthly payments due, it's all covered by financial aid? Is that how you cover it?
Yeah, I mean, our students do set up with payment plans in advance of enrollment.
You're 100% financial aid. The student's getting, let's say, he's a dependent student, and the parents are taking out plus. Every penny owed to you come in from financial aid, or maybe even a VA student. They still sign a payment plan saying that they're not making any payments, and it's all expected to come from financial aid. Is that what your payment plan looks like?
Well, there are some things that, room, board, fees, lab fees, and things like that. So they're a meal plan. There's always going to be a few items that are not necessarily 100% covered.
But in theory, a dependent student plan is getting plus could, in fact, take out 100% to cover everything.
Yeah. So,
and if your payment plan has that, then in here, just make some mention that you understand that the title funds expected from Title IV. And VA, they don't always pay very quickly either from what I've seen from other schools. So just make sure you make some reference that if money is coming from some other organization, that they are not going to be charged a interest rate while you're waiting on the money coming, which doesn't absolve them from getting you everything needed. So if a student plans on being a Title IV student and say they're selected for verification,
right,
if they don't meet those obligations to get you what you need, you're welcome to do whatever, but
right,
this just has to say that you're acknowledging those who are eligible, and if, you know, however you want to say it, has met all of the, you know, requirements, that they're not going to charge you for those. That would be great.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we will.
And the next time you come for us and have to give us an example, do like sample students on this. We know what they're seeing, because this is really not attractive or compelling.
Any other questions?
Constructive advice.
May I make a motion?
Yeah.
I move to approve the 2019 regular degree granting license renewal by stipulated agreement to maintain $1,000 bond and continue to provide electronic copies of student records on a monthly basis. I think that.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Bye.
Dr. Jennifer.
And I'm Paul Mitten.
We have a motion by Dr. Paul Mitten, and we have a second by Dr. Book. Any further discussion? Do you accept the stipulation?
Yes.
All those in favor?
Glenn Thorpe, aye.
Mike Romano, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye.
Paul Mitten, aye.
Dr. Jennifer, like, aye.
Motion passes.
Dick Lutke, aye.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. The next item on the agenda is the conditional vocational program license application for Promenio Tech. Fourth young man. Ms. Sample.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. At your meeting last month, the board postponed action on the application submitted by Promenio Education doing business as Promenio Tech. They are seeking a conditional non-accredited vocational program license to offer back-end and front-end developer programs. The board had requested several revisions to the enrollment agreement and the catalog. Those revisions were provided to Mr.
Sewin.
For correction. He did provide to us a summary of those revisions, and I believe many of those were corrected in the new enrollment agreement catalog submitted. And again, you have Mr. Sewin here as representing the applicant.
Which Mr. Sewin?
Junior. Okay. Not really junior.
Don't confuse me.
The younger one.
Mr. Sewin, I would like to note that we beat our time from last time by about 4 hours, so we're really saving you half a day here. So would you like to make an opening statement?
I would, thank you. First, thank you. As Mr. Mittman mentioned, you guys do a lot of work. I've had quite a time putting together one enrollment agreement. I can't understand how you guys take care of all these ones. especially Terry, Keith, and Rachel. I appreciate the help. I want to give you a brief background of why I'm doing what I'm doing. That may have come across in some of the letters that I sent back, but just so you know, software development for me has been something that I have a passion for. I extremely enjoy it. It's fun. It's creative. It stretches my mind. But then when I got into education, post-secondary, a different vocational school, I found a different passion that I found more fulfillment from, and that's helping students. I saw some really good things happen while I was at that school, and I really enjoyed it, and I was able to help a lot of students. Unfortunately, things shifted, new branding and priorities changed, and that dragged away from that, and I saw some not so good things happen at the expense of students. And so when that happened, there were things that happened that I couldn't stand by. So I resigned, and I said there has to be a better way to do this. It's a newer industry for software development, and there has to be a better way to help students get that without having the risk they have to take on and the high interest rates. And so I was kind of moved by the passion I had found there to find something more beneficial. And that's why you see the payment plan that you've read here. Despite the risk of it, it's a social mission of mine to help give that back. This past month has been very educational for me. From last month on the 25th all the way through, 30 seconds ago. it's also been it's been the most my heart's beat since wrestling 10 years ago. Before I turn the time back over to you, I just want to go over a few things that happened this past month to show kind of my progression to address your guys' concerns, the board's concerns, and other things I've done to take proactive steps to tighten up our model and better benefit us and the students in the long run. So first off, I addressed the concerns, that list that the board sent, and I appreciate that feedback. It was very helpful. I met Fred and joined APSA, which has helped me learn a lot more about the industry. Attended that conference last month. Was that this month? I attended that conference. And
oh, it is.
It was this month.
It was this month?
Whoa. It was the 3rd, right? May 3rd. It's my brother. I learned a lot more about the board and current legislature. We had a homegrown entrance exam that we were going to have students take to determine if they can attend our program. We replaced that with the Wanderlick SLEQ exam instead, and have the scores recommended by them for software developers. We moved all of our financing to a third party. It's TFC tuition financing, so that we don't have to carry any of that or deal with the licensure needed to be a consumer lender. I did research on employment verification, found ways to fairly and legally accomplish that, and I spent a handful of hours at the Pima Medical Institute Phoenix location with Stacy, where she shared a bunch of best practices. So I've been excited to get to meet people that can help guide me through this. And I hope that I'm doing it right, and I appreciate your guidance, and hope that today we'll be able to move forward with the social mission that I'm trying to accomplish. And I'd be happy to answer any questions or concerns that everybody has.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. And thank you very much for the effort you've put forward. There's no doubt you've taken a lot of the feedback from the board here. You've found new networking relationships. You've started to look at outside opportunities of resources that are available to you, such as an entrance exam through Wunderlich, and then somebody else managing the financing pieces of it. So those are all great steps for us. So we appreciate, and I think it's really a good example of how the board working with an educational institution can work hand in hand to help add value to our consumers and people who are seeking education. So we share your passion with that. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and thank you for that piece of it. I have had a chance to look over the materials, and as you've stated, you've made a number of corrections. There's a couple questions I have that are probably just more just trying to seek to understand, and I might have missed it somewhere in some of my reviews. A couple things, for example, going to the catalog, back to the catalog, on page 6, I'm assuming that when a student stops attending and goes into, I guess, repayment and fails to meet that repayment schedule, that the third party clarifies that, at what point that happens. I know in these types of income sharing agreements that are out there, that it can vary depending on 60 days, 30 days, 90 days. So I just wanted to kind of verify that the student going through that does have awareness of when that takes effect.
Yes. So this points to the, so you're talking about 6C under the tuition payment option 1A3?
It probably would fall in under that particular piece of it. It's on page 6, and it, sorry, got to get to the actual catalog. But it talks about specifically if a student were to fail to notify the lending institution that they're working, that they'd go into repayment. But it didn't really stipulate at what point. Like, is that immediate or what? So you don't necessarily have to answer. I just wanted you to be aware of that piece of it, and it might be something you want to go back and just verify that the consumer would have knowledge of when that happens. I do know it varies by agreement and institution.
Yes, thank you.
Just to verify, too, on page 7, you talk about class times, specifically lab times, moving. I'm interpreting it as the cohort of students. It's not shifting constantly for them, so they don't know when the lab's at, but more so once you kind of pick a date for when the labs are happening for a cohort, they stay consistent. Is that
correct?
Your interpretation?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Number 16, or I'm sorry, page 16, I just wanted to bring this to your awareness. You have a statement here. The way I'm interpreting it on page 16, and it's under the withdrawal piece. It's probably, I guess, I'm going to say second paragraph down. You actually say students terminated for any other reason other than academic performance will be liable for repayment. And the way I interpret that is if I academically fail out of the program where I'm not successful, I do not owe anything from to a lender for the program. Is that an accurate statement?
Correct. So this is specifically, so the story behind this is the deferred payment, the until you get a job. So if they fail out academically because they just can't do it, then they don't have to pay back that money. They paid that 10% deposit up front. That was their investment. But if they show up, go halfway through the program, and say, I just don't want to do this anymore, then they are liable for the percentage as calculated through the refund policy. And I feel like this...
Mark, they'll intentionally fail.
Yeah.
Yes, and that is the loophole, which we're willing to stand by that. But
all right, I just want to make sure I was interpreting that the right
yes,
way.
Yes, it is correct.
I will share... income sharing agreements, groups will normally state that regardless of if you complete the program or not, once you go out, if you hit the threshold of the income necessary, you are still required to pay that back. So totally your choice as an institution. Just wanted to clarify that I was understanding that correctly, and that might be something that you might want to talk with that third party about. That they may put those practices in place at other institutions.
Okay, so, no, I appreciate you pointing that out. So you've seen institutes have, so just theoretically, someone could attend for a week or 2 weeks and then drop out, and then they'd still be liable if they...
Even if they academically failed out of the program, they would still be responsible for repaying it if they hit the income threshold that was assigned at that time. So, again, I really like your approach, but to my fellow colleagues up here, you may find other people find that loophole and and take advantage of it. And because of the significant demand in the program in industry and people's willingness not to necessarily have certifications or that stuff to get somebody in, that may be a point of risk for you, just to keep in mind. But
17 weeks in the academic.
And so, you know, certainly if then all of a sudden you took exception to that and a collector started calling that person to get funds back because you felt that was the fair thing to do, the way your agreement currently reads right now, you would not be entitled to do that. Okay.
Not only that, but also the fact that you've output costs and to teach the students. So what you're doing is actually potentially going into debt, although, again, applauding for the thought of it, you will have a hard time sustaining, which I think we would care about financially.
It depends on how many people end up dropping out. So one sidebar thought is this homegrown test that you did that you're not using as admissions criteria. If you still use that, if you think that's a good predictor of success separately, but not using it as a subjective thing, you stick with the one to learn score. But if that test is a good predictor of whether they'll succeed or not, you could still give it and then do some counseling with the students saying, well, hey, you passed the test here, but just to let you know, this shows you have some struggles because this test is a good predictor of whether you'll do well. Like, I'm a financial aid, and if the person says that they're not good at math, that, like, really worries me. I don't think they're going to succeed. So if this test really is an indicator of whether they'll do well or not, you might not prevent them from enrolling, but it might be one of those things that you tell them you're going to struggle, and then maybe you can even help them decide how far along they're going to stick if they start having troubles right after that.
Okay.
It just depends. I mean, I don't know what your test is, but if it's something that you feel really helps figure it out and not use it as a tool, not as an initial tool, that's a counselor.
It's a good idea, and then I haven't wasted the time developing it.
There you go.
Thank you.
Well, and as you work on that, you want to look at reliability and validity of that tool, too, mm-hmm. before you try and utilize that as something significant and hold to.
Yeah, some people are not good test takers, so it could be someone does poorly, and you talk to them and say, you know, based on this, you think you can struggle, so let's have a plan. Have you set up time to study? Are you prepared to put the effort in? They say, yes, if I do, and then they'd be great. The next person doesn't do well, say, you know what, we have had people score you scored and succeed, but here's the effort they put in to do it. Are you prepared to do it? You know, so it's just one of those things that might just really help you in your counseling, which is above and beyond. But if you end up having a low dropout rate, it's worth the effort you put in. If you have a high dropout rate, you probably have to consider your payment structure and also your entrance requirements. Like, whatever you pick as your one to like entrance, if it turns out that people are, you know, getting low scores in that, everyone who gets a certain, you know, range of scores all end up or a high percent pass out, you might consider raising your score. And I see a lot when I audit schools, I see they change their entry requirements and they always have a backup of why. Oh yeah, we studied it and, you know, the 10 students stopped, 8 of them were in this range, and so we felt that we had to increase our score. So keep track of those things because it affects you more than most, because most schools, student drops out, they're keeping 10, 20, 30, 40%. You're keeping nothing but still $700. So just to be viable, like Dr. said, make sure that you're financially viable as part of being a successful business in general.
Thank you. Last thing I have is just page 18. You have a repetitive statement in your catalog, about 14, in the procedures to resolve student grievances, item number 3, and then you repeat the same kind of paragraph immediately thereafter. So just, you know, a little formality thing cleaning up. Not a big deal. Other than that, I know last time we talked about instructor qualifications and that piece of it, and ultimately, I'm not aware, and I didn't see anywhere where you did define any qualification necessary for your instructors or anything of that nature. I don't know if you settled on trying to set some threshold for that or not.
We did. I sent back, unfortunately, that's the one document that I forgot to print out. I did send that back. I can't remember what it is. I apologize. But it was completing a vocational program or a degree and or at least 2 years of experience in the industry.
Okay.
And then preferably teaching experience.
Okay.
Or an ability, that this one is more subjective, but an ability to demonstrate that they can teach technical details in land use zone.
Okay. I appreciate that piece of it. And after reviewing the three parties, that would be considered, or really the two that would be considered for the instructor. You and the other have work experience and certainly some certificate and course completion as well for the other individual. So I appreciate you taking a look at that piece of it. I have no other questions.
Hey, Lisa. First, on that piece, I think it's great that you're allowing teachers who maybe don't have a degree because they want self-taught, because a lot of people are programming, that is the piece. But having some qualification, not just that they took a class or a week type thing, so that's really good. And the part about trying to judge the ability to teach, if they had been in any sort of a supervisor or a management position or a mentoring position, that might help you judge their ability. So you don't have to put that in writing, but just to yourself when you're working with them. Because then they're being subjective, which doesn't have anything to do with us. If you choose not to hire an instructor, they're not going to complain to us.
Okay.
But just for yourself as a business person, some complaints, why didn't you get a job? You've never got anything to show them. But being supervisor and mentor, all of those are. Then again, some people have never taught, you can teach them how to teach radio. People who are really good at something are not always good at teaching it. People teach it really well are not always the greatest at doing it.
Those that can't be teach.
I'm sure faculty can
say that. No, we have that on the record.
Just saying that's a popular statement.
It is.
It goes to what you were just saying.
Teachers are both great at what they do. Some people just, explain it better than actually executing it. Some execute great, but they can't explain it their way out of the bag, But if you get a lot of complaints about the instructor, then you'll hear about that. The students come in and say, I didn't learn anything because the instructor didn't know what he was talking about. Then you'll come for a complaint committee, and your goal might be not come for a complaint committee. I'm sure you made that clear in the meeting. Just make it terrible. But I only have two things. You did a really good job. That was a long list that he and I both had that we passed on to the staff that passed on to you. And there were only two of mine you didn't end up making. So you might have chosen not to do it, and then you can explain it. One of them is on the enrollment agreement. You're calling it an enrollment fee, and everywhere else you call it a registration fee. Based on how they worded it, would appear it is in fact a registration fee. So just one spot on the enrollment agreement, we still call it enrollment fee. So do a search and replace on that one.
And then it's on the, in the enrollment agreement, I call it.
On the enrollment agreement. Okay, it is under other cancellations. So the second paragraph, there's a 3-day cancellation, and then there's other cancellation. Last sentence on that, you say, all money's paid less than enrollment fee of $200.
Mm-hmm.
And everywhere else you call the registration. And there's just a difference. Those words not interchangeable. And then on page 7, I'm notoriously poor at penmanship, so I'm kind of following it. I had objected to how it was worded last time, because it sounded like students did or didn't sign made a huge difference how they were charged. And it looks like you did make a change, but you mentioned in the very last paragraph, if the student does not sign the agreement, the student will be refunded 100% of any payments made. So this means you're giving up your registration fee, by the way you worded that. Did you mean to do that?
I did mean to.
And it could be because if they said they were going to start on July 1st, and they're postponing it to August 1st, if you're keeping $100 because you already got it in July and you're not charging for the August, but it's sort of confusing. So, but as written, if I were the student, I would think if I'm choosing to postpone the start date, and even though with the 3-day cancellation, whatever, you'd be entitled to keep that registration fee, if I'm going to change the start date and then I don't sign an enrollment agreement, you're not going to charge me it. If that's what you mean, that's great. That is what you say. If it's not what you mean, you need to fix it and say that you would just be keeping you know, subject to the refund policy, which would then flip back to the 3 days and blah, blah, blah.
I was looking at that as if the school postpones it, then I'm going to give them all their money back because that's not theirs.
Perfect.
But it does. I do see up here it says whether requested of the school or student. So maybe just differentiating if it's the school.
Yes. So if you say it's the school, you're going to give back everything, including the registration fee. That would be really awesome. Or if the student postpones it, are they then subject to keeping the registration fee depending on how many days? Then say that. Otherwise, when that's written, you are going to get 100% no matter what.
Okay. Thank you.
Which is fine with me if you give the students back more money, less to complain about. But but if you keep it and this says you give it back, then they're not complaining.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
No, again, I just reiterate, we commend you. A lot of people appear in front of this board and get advice about how to fix things and liaison with the community and do nothing with it. You did the opposite. We appreciate that. That will make you a much better school. And you probably won't be in front of us all that often.
And a big thank you to FEMA for being willing to have their staff spend the time with you. And that's actually one very nice thing that I have found about this community is that people, unless you're in direct competition with them, they're usually very good about sharing the knowledge. And going to the APSA conference is a really good way of networking with the conference. So you would be a good idea.
Again. I have one more thing, and more just a question. So between the three options, in option number option number three, you actually forego the registration fee. But in option number two, you don't. And they're both kind of – so the option two is paying in full, right, which you'd think is a really big positive. You do give $1,000 for that one. But then you have the other one, which is kind of taking out the income sharing agreement mm-hmm. approach. And so I was just curious, like the way you have that worded, if I were a student enrolling, I might be like, hey, I'm paying you full and you're still going to charge me the registration fee, where this other one, where it's going to be deferred until after, it just seemed like a interesting approach, that's all. And I was curious why you might have taken that.
Originally, you had a word that was more confusing to me, and when you did this one, it sounds to me like you're doing escort of an incentive. Your grandest hope is that they will pay you $6,800 total, then you're good, right?
Yes.
Yes, and then the third one, it is weird, unless you are saying that $200 registration fee is included within those payments, then maybe it would be good to clarify that.
So in option three, I am waiving the 200, so I need to
clarify.
You are waiving.
Yeah,
it says you're waiving it.
So why aren't you waiving it if they pay you all of them?
It seems like it.
Because they are paying more. I mean, they're paying $7,020 if they pay out over the whole thing. So they are, in fact, getting a better deal. But it does feel like a little bit, it could be the same dollars, but it does feel a little bit unfair.
You might at least be aware that students may ask that question of why are you waiving it for option three but not waiving it for option two? So not that you have to add more onto the $1,000, but you may just want to be prepared.
And they save the $420, I think, in all our friends. But like
well, it's that interpretation, that's all. So I'm
like
just
that.
Curious about that. So if there are no further questions, I would like to make a motion.
I just noticed, I think I just saw a typo under option two. I will make a lump sum payment 1 week prior to start of classes.
I saw the O, but I wasn't missing O, but I wasn't going to get in to start doing.
Okay,
typo.
Well, I just saw it, so
that may drive me insane, and I'd have to pound my head against the wall.
That would most certainly drive.
It's there.
It's there.
It is. All right. So with that, I'd like to make a motion that we approve the conditional vocational program licensure application with the stipulation of the $15,000 surety bond.
Motion by Mr. Romano, do you have a second?
Glenn Tharp, second.
Second. Do you accept the
I do.
Okay. Mr. Romano? All those in favor?
Glenn Tharp, aye.
Mr.
Mike Romano, aye.
Chris Leonard, aye.
Paul Mittman, aye.
Dr. Jennifer Leck, aye.
Dick Lipke, aye.
Sorry. Mr. Lipke, what say you?
Aye, aye, aye.
We should have a picture of the missing board members so that don't carry away. So congratulations.
Cardboard stand out.
You did a great job. That was launching.
Pointing up.
Yeah.
Well, so we're always worried about people having the initial capability and having more enthusiasm than actual great hope for you. So, good luck for your report.
Thank you very much.
All right, there we go. So for those, since it's recorded, those who can't see it, there was an enthusiastic wave for the licensing of Lemony Effect. Minutes, board business.
Yes, Madam Chair. Just wanted to, in the report, I gave to you the number of the supplementals that we approved and the April license renewals that we approved. Also, the two schools that chose not to renew in this last cycle is Colette Academy and Discovery Detective Academy. They had been licensed by us for a very long time.
Are they closing? Is that why
they didn't renew? No, they have their Detective Academy. I mean, they have their other, it's just
secret.
They were, enrollment was very low. Obviously, quite a few schools in teach out. Which brings me to why the proposed orientation video that I wanted to discuss with you. You'll notice, what were we at a high? 270 schools, we're now at
204.
Keeps going down, 204. Then when these are closed out, we're going to be under 100.
200 or under 100?
In the
200. Under 200.
That's good.
Cut this board right in half.
Right in half. Which means, as when I did the budget last year, it just makes it even worse that if we don't do something in 2 or 3 years, we are not here.
What are our options to do?
This, that he's going to carry.
Hello?
Jeez, snappy.
This is our, this, snappy. This could be our life. This could bring us back.
How about that? It says that the legislature says that the schools can't charge.
Well, that was Ohio's.
I thought you said that was ours.
No, that's Ohio.
That's an example.
Ohio, the bottom part, I thought you said this.
No, both of those are, that's Ohio's. Ohio's, when Kevin and I were at NASAPS in Jacksonville, we were talking to John. John, where you'd have to know John. He's from Ohio. A lot of you guys who have other schools there. He came up with this idea because he's faced exactly the same scenario we are faced with. So they put together a student orientation video that all newly enrolled students of all institutions have to, and put it in law, have to take this orientation video. If you didn't watch it, it is really cool. One of the things that we have heard through closures is the students say, we didn't know you were here. And this clearly tells them who the board is, gives them really good information about the school. What, it's 4 or 5 minutes? And I gave you the link on here.
Yeah,
I
and
really
I just sent it to each
of
you.
You should watch it. But if all newly enrolled students...
I'm watching this now.
And do it as a pass-through. I guess it'd be your choice. It'd be the institution's choice, but it could do it as a pass-through, where And of course, we'd have to get the legislature to approve this, and Fred and his group has agreed to carry it, because we could do a split. And this is just throwing it out here. This is kind of how Ohio did it. But we were thinking, let's say $25. And $25 is not going to cost the student that much. Everybody can afford $25, I think, maybe. Well, the schools can do a pass-through.
Yeah, that's what we call it. Schools
pass-through, yeah. And you can't tell me the schools can't do but $5 for the platform, because they do all the work, collect all the fees, so on and so forth, do all the billing, or however it works. $5 to our operating budget. $5 to Strife, because Strife has taken a serious hit. We'll have to bill for the next 400. I'm being dramatic. We'll Strife for a long time. We'll be billing for Strife, but we won't be here. Because you want to get real blunt. And then $5 to the association.
So if the feedback you've gotten is that the administration is not up to you for the board fees to be charged, because they don't think that the businesses who are making money should have to give any more money for their license, do you think that they would approve us to just...
This is not a fee charged to... as a taxpayer, not a fee.
I mean, I'm not opposed to it. It's just, it's one of those things that just that since you've got feedback before, so they won't let you raise your rates to schools, and the schools are
licensing
fees,
right.
The students are, you know, like you said, some of them can't afford the bus. Oh, so it makes it, okay.
That will probably be why.
But we can sell this.
And the school could have a choice of not doing it, but the school could choose to pay it.
Yes.
Who does this apply to?
Every enrolled student of all licensed institutions.
Okay, but you, so let's
just
I just need to be real.
No one's exempt.
Okay. Well, someone I know, they work for, has a traditional campus that looks like a state institution, which has a lot of new enrollment. Every year in the thousands.
Uh-huh. I can't see that far.
It's a big number.
It's a big crazy. Number.
It's
just a tad. It's just a campus. The recording math is being shown.
If it passed through, you would have a litany of fees on your enrollment, not you. There are a litany of fees of on an enrollment agreement for a student, graduation, transcript. This would be a student orientation fee, $25.
I appreciate the creativeness around trying to help find the balance. I'm probably sensitive to the thought of students now having to compensate for, I guess, us being out of balance, the best way to say it. And I realize that there's limitations on what an administration might allow us to do from a fee standpoint, but I'm struggling with the answer ultimately being the student pays for it, or an institution does pays for it, and so we're kind of now putting it on the institution to say, okay, you charge $25, and the student then says, I don't have $25, and I'm not going to start school because of that, because believe it or not, students do struggle with making a smaller payment at that at various times. And then the institution saying, so the way I have to do it is kind of come off this type of money. It just seems like you're attacking my business to be able to fund this entity. So I think it's a slippery slope, and I would just be really cautious of that.
I
oh, because the student is paid into it, therefore they should be entitled to that much money.
Which they should be. Unfortunately, and we have seen it, there's been large regionally accredited, but that's now changing with the department. With the orientation, if you haven't watched it, I would encourage you to watch it. It's very informative. It tells the students not only about who this board is, which everyone has, you hear that historically all the time. Didn't know you were here.
No, we have that statement that the students don't understand some of the grievance world. They don't put it in our application, then
we would also then have their emails, which will be could be critical to, we could either do surveys, or if the institution closes, we can now contact and reach the student.
I think logistically trying to get students to do it is another whole ballgame.
I echo Mike's concern, Mr. Romano's concern for that, just because I run a school, which is Allied Health, which is different than, say, people that have more resources that would go to a four-year. I have people that can't eat, that we have food banks. So to pass another charge onto them is very, now if the school's willing to pay it, you know, then that's different. But I also have questions around Title IV. Would that fee be something you could cover with Title IV? I don't think so either. And so I still know quite a few operators in Ohio, so I'm going to actually call the schools and see, try to get a framework of how they're taking care of that cost or deferring it. And I could share that with the board next time.
Even for board staff, if they can maybe get an estimate of, I don't know if this is possible for you guys, how many new enrollment they do per year, maybe it doesn't have to be $25.
Yeah, maybe you'll be graduated on the amount.
Exactly.
Because what I pay, we're rolling 400 or 500 students, is a lot different than Dr. Lex got to pay, and school's got to pay.
You could look into whether, based on how the fee is charged, whether it could be covered by Title IV, or based on the fee is charged to all students and are being repaid. I've never heard this particular thing, but that doesn't mean it can't make fall under categories, so it's something we would want to look into.
And I appreciate the discussion, but we're very in problem-solving mode. And I don't even understand the problem. Like, what is the gap that exists? And are there other ways that we can offset that gap? I mean, I realize, again, the administration may not be necessarily supportive of fee increases, but we may find that a fee increase is nominal compared to what's being described here. And we might be able to go out to our schools to solicit feedback to say, here's where we're at, and this could be a potential solution, and then find the administration to be supportive based on how we've built consensus within the group. But until we know what the gap is, I think that's what we kind of have to solve for, and then how we may spread that out amongst the remaining institutions to help balance the budget. This is a balancing the budget type of scenario. I just don't want us to suddenly start saying, here's the solution without us not, and maybe everybody else has clarity on this. I apologize if I've missed something from what that projected gap could be, but I think it's worth discussing.
I think it makes sense because the number of schools here that have been down, some of them because of legislative changes from other years, but their administration has changed by all the work it takes. And the amount we charge for application is very low for most other states, and we haven't been allowed to use it. I think that our fee structure is truly a problem.
We have not raised fees since 96.
That's generally where boards would source their operating costs from, is the fees, and I think the big fear has been that the legislature has not been very supportive of increasing fees. Once again, that's a great idea, saying if these are your two options, a pass-through versus increasing fees, what would you prefer? I think there needs to be a lot more legwork on this.
Yeah, seeing where those gaps lie, you know, I have no frame of reference. So they just say, hey, we have a gap,
And when the budget was done last year, it showed that based on our revenues and our expenses, in 3 years, we will have gone through our fund balance, and this board is no longer has any money.
I did see that.
What's the difference, though?
We also know we've had changes even since then, so we need to recalculate based on...
I will be doing the budget. It's due again in September.
September.
Look at the things that you guys do, like all the work that you have to do, Cameron, is still paid. That's not something that's being charged with. It's after the fact. It has to be back in there. But all of the back and forth you do with the schools, with the catalogs, the enrollment agreements, and you do with the entire packet, or however you guys break that work up, and add in campuses. If you look at what the fees are and try to just see offhand, like how much time, like what things takes the most. If you have a school that has three locations, it all similar, everything is the same. If it is big of a deal for the other locations or less, and just figure out maybe if there's some way of legalistic structures, like for the people don't charge appropriately for what it is to take a lot of work. And some of these things, they're definitely paper. We could get in a binder like this, and sometimes it takes me anywhere from 8 to 16 hours to prepare for one of these meetings. And you guys have already gone through all that stuff over and over and over again. I don't even know how many hours you all spend to do your part, instead of you, relative to the $200 you're getting to do it. You know what I mean? So I think that, I'm a consultant, so in my business, I'm looking at people want me to write policy and procedures. That's a big old chunk of change. They want me to, you kind of buy it. That's a different amount, because I charge based on what I'm doing.
And we kind of went, we did, a couple years ago, we went down that road based upon the number of programs offered per institution, and that was shocking.
And that might be because it's based on the programs, like, since we're not actually evaluating the troop education piece, maybe that's not the right cost part.
We were doing it on new schools. There it makes a difference. Yeah.
I guess I would think that they'd be very supportive of the institutions that are going, that are doing teach-outs or going under, that have these bonds on, that have a continuous follow-up by the board for so long. I would think that they would be okay with, some kind of fee to process a teach-out. I mean, that's where...
They're already in trouble. Those schools are there already.
I know, isn't the bond already there?
Oh, that's not what you're saying.
Yes.
No.
The bond doesn't cover that.
Correct.
Maybe it should, I guess, is my point.
Yeah,
you have to get a statutory change to include coverage right now. The bond,
only covers
violations of state statute and costs, fiscal obligations that are incurred as a result of a direct violation of an actual board statute.
So it's not violent.
But no, so like, for example, one of the things is that they are responsible to submit all records to the board within X amount of days of closure. So if they don't do that and the board has to send a truck to go pick them up on day 11, then we can try to file a claim against the bond because the board was obligated by their failure to go do that. However, the ongoing maintenance or in perpetuity of the record is not an obligation of the school because it's a statutory obligation of the board to maintain those records. So that is not a cost that we can build with a bond.
I would assume now, but no matter what we're talking about, we're going to have to get some kind of change in order to support that. And my only point is that if the year after an institution closes has a huge amount of work in the amount of following up with the institution, trying to deal with all the students, trying to help, then maybe it's not in perpetuity, but maybe it's, some kind of fee per month for institution based on the number of students or something, because that's really where you're...
But they will have closed.
But you got the bond.
I don't know. I think
what's
we seriously
the bond, they already have
fee increases again. If they say no, they say no. But I think we have a pretty compelling case to go through to to do
I
that.
Think,
the video, can I just finish, Frankie, sorry. The video, whether we charge for it or not, I think it's something we should do, even if we, you know, we can cover it, because I do think it's good to put out there to say this is who we are and what we do and such.
I just don't know how we're going to have, like, for example, me, just one part of the university's 7,000 students do that. I will feel
forget
if I get 7,000 18-year-olds to go through a video.
That'd be awesome.
So I think what I'm hearing is that board member Romano would be happier discussing this if once the new budget has been so that we actually have accurate numbers that would reflect the potential deficit. But I do think the board should schedule an overarching discussion about the budget and then start proposing some potential solutions at that point. And we could discuss this again, not limiting it to this, but also talking about increasing the free fee structure, talking about the strife, and seeing if we can do something with strife, because that really has been a major hit on the board's budget.
And I can just give you a brief update on strife. So last year we collected $174,000 in strife fees from institutions. This year, based on my review of where we're going to be about $117,000 that we collect. Of that, this year we've spent $180,000,
$190,000
out of it.
Gone.
So we're not close to the half a million. So we're every year, based on the closures, the long-term cost associated with a closure, that we're, in a few years, just in strife alone, we will be zeroed out. We won't be able to.
We're still paying $2,000 a month. 7,000 boxes that are over the Iron Mountain.
Correct.
That's kind of my point, though.
Well, how do you divvy out schools that have closed forever? I mean,
I know, but at least if you can charge some kind of fee for the first 12 months, it will help offset, you know what I mean, some of it. Right now, we got nothing.
It's just like
you're going to get blood out of a turnip.
Someone's got to fail and you want to have a bond and they can't afford the bond, it's 6 days of closure.
And I'll just let you know, like, claiming off the bond is a whole nother procedure legally for my office. So we only have 1 year from the date of closure to file the claims and to sue them into session for each claim. That means for these Argosy students, I mean, worst case scenario, if all 448 decided to file a claim, that's 448 separate actions I have to take. They're an insurance company. It's their job not to pay that money, or to find a loophole or something. So we submitted the first?
Yes.
Okay, so we've submitted three claims, I believe, so far to one of the bonds. We'll see how that goes, but it's a process. And they can say no to certain things, especially if the statutes seem vague to them, and that's something that we'll have to go to court for to argue out.
Just like we're going to have to pay up front for that moving truck to move those 800 boxes. How many boxes?
500 plus 500 the 80. There were
that
we have to send
Georgia.
To Georgia.
So the bonds are great.
We have to
in
pay
theory.
For up front.
To go to Georgia?
Is the scope of the Finance Committee, not trying to add more work, our commitment to that group, but just trying to understand the scope of that committee, if they are also reviewing the budget for the state board and that, or more so for other institutions? Because I would, if that isn't the case, which I'm not recommending it become the case, but it probably makes sense for a smaller group of us to come together, possibly a special committee, to just try and first pull information together, vet it out, and then possibly even bring recommendations forward to the collective board. So instead of everybody trying to, you know, boil the ocean, maybe a handful of us kind of jump in and take a look, examine some of the updated financials and preparation for the budget that's coming forth in September, that would give us a better idea of the gap that we're potentially dealing with, how far off that is, and then what type of revenue offset we would need, as well as address some of the questions that Dr. Leck has brought forward, which is these endless costs that are resulting from school closures that will ultimately, unless we find a more cost-appropriate measure of managing that information will continue to bleed us dry over the years to come.
So I think there may be value in...
That's a good idea. You are statutorily allowed, your chairwoman is allowed to form any committee that's necessary to carry out a function of the board. So you can appoint 2-3 people if you'd like. You don't have to do it today, but if you'd like to.
We have some volunteers for it. That would be great. So do I need a motion for you then?
No, you're allowed to just appoint them. I just have the power. Yes, so, you have the power. It says the chairman may establish from board membership a committee necessary to carry out the
budget
function
committee.
Of the board. So if you'd like a budget committee.
I would like to establish a budget committee so that an evaluation can be done of our current charging of fees. And I would recommend a pair from other states how they're doing it. And we have one volunteer. Maybe three people would
three people would be perfect, I believe.
We have more volunteers.
I'll help because I think I represent one way different side than
so Dr. Mitten and Dr. Leck and
yes, just Mr. Ramon. And if we could try and tack that on to like our finance committee, complaint committee kind of day.
I give you the power. I'm passing the power. You have to watch out for the
happy hour.
Good solutions.
No, I want to be on the committee.
It's got to be open meeting.
It's going to be, yes.
And you got, just so you know, the state's fiscal year end is June 30th. Mm-hmm. And the budget is due to the governor's office by September 1st. And if you want to propose any statutory changes, it needs to be talk to the people next door prior to November.
For the next session.
For the next session. There's a short time frame.
Let's also be realistic so we don't have a false deadline. We know we're not running out of money next year. It's a couple years down the road. So we don't have to resolve everything within the next couple months. But it's good to start the legwork to start moving us forward.
Especially if it's a small fee increase made sooner lasts longer. The longer we wait to do it, the higher fees we have to be to help us out.
Right. And just so that, you know, I'm learning the ins and outs of state government, which is a little different than the corporate world. Just so that we all understand, if we propose if we want to go forward and say that we will have some additional fee changes and or a strife change, and we start that process in 19, legislatively it wouldn't even be heard until 20. And it wouldn't be in place until, if I understand right, until the end of the year or in 2021. That's the best case. That's if we had it written today. And we had a number of legislators that were interested in taking up our cause. That would be 2021 before we would see an impact. So we're all used to, if we make a change, there's a revenue impact probably in the next 6 months but not in our case.
I do have from a legislative standpoint, there definitely were some senators that we went through our reappointment process who clearly were very, very interested in what needs to be done to help the whole impact of school closure. So I think we do have some people who are sensitive to the issues who presented succinctly and may be very willing to help.
I think the Argosy closure really had an impact that was different than what we've had in the past with ITT or any of the other institutions.
Absolutely.
Because those students were contacting their state legislator.
They were
contacting the U.S. Senate. They did a very good job of communicating their concerns, and I think that's what we heard, too, when Terry and I met with the senators.
Okay, so this was agendized as a discussion action on the student disclosure video, so I think we're wandering a little far out. There's been a commission established for the committee members. Please do not speak with each other about the budget. However, you are permitted to ask any of the staff members for additional information or explanation or anything. They can send out stuff to all three of you. You just cannot discuss it with each other outside of a meeting or email each other or call each other or anything like that. So if you have any questions, please make sure you reach out to staff.
So what you're like, I am going to do some research for Ohio, just back to the agenda.
Yes.
I don't share that with anybody?
You share it with Terry.
Okay.
And Terry will distribute it to the board members. They are just not to discuss it with each other outside of a committee meeting.
So yeah, anything, and that goes for any board members. If you do find something that you believe the committee should take under advisement or explore, just go ahead and give it to Terry. She'll make sure everybody gets the right information.
And then separately on the video, we already have the requirement that the school has to have our information under agreement. Do we have to get verbiage changed to require schools to do a little more and maybe have it as, word of the week and find it more friendly? Like school closures, I don't think any students can say, oh, that I have a grievance about that, let me go find it. Is it that we could require that, but if not the video, some sort of a statement that says, in the case of any, like even, complaint, so just some wording that your average everyday person who's not involved in regulations would know that.
If you want it to be mandatory or as part of their licensing, it's probably going to require a rule change at least within their application packet that they provide their students at the time of enrollment with information regarding how to file a complaint, a separate piece of information. But yeah, that's something that the board could probably discuss doing a rule change to make it a little bit more.
I think it is confusing for students. Like in my mind, I look and see who they like to spot, so I know who to go point to, right? But I don't know.
We could talk about in the future if and when the board is going to submit a new rules package, that maybe the institutions be required to furnish information about the location, contact, and what the board does.
How about, do we have to do anything for them to put something on their website? Right now, there's something that puts off the existing.
We need a rule or a statute in order to require an institution to do anything.
I just want to say I appreciate the content of the video. I just want us to appreciate a student going through orientation, excited about starting school, and right now, if you haven't sat through orientations, they're hit with things like Title IX, harassment of people.
Right.
They're hit with, loan repayments and all these negatives. And so if you think they're listening and they're going to listen to this, that's a short-sighted plan as well. So I realize we have a bigger issue here to discuss, but I would just... It seems like a plug and play. I'd encourage you to sit through an orientation and you might see, wow, that was an eye opener of all this stuff unrelated to their pursuit of actual education, but a lot of legal ease that scares the crap out of them and makes them wonder, boy, if you have to put all this small print in place, should I even be going to an institution like this? So I just ask for a balanced look.
That's why having it just as students need it, they can look up and find it more readily. That's what the students don't think when we built in the conversation. They said they had no idea we existed or how to find it. And they were smart. Those guys, they were smart. And they clearly did all this research and they kind of stumbled upon it.
I guess I would be interested because, for us, I put it everywhere that we have accreditation or authorization. I put it everywhere we have an appeal process. I put it everywhere, yeah. I mean, it's...
And again, I think to Dr. Leck's point, which is where I was going, I mean, we disclose it, it's on our wall, we talk about it on every tour, it's in our catalog, there's got to be some consumer ownership of that as well,
I know, but if you Google something and you're looking up something, you want it to be some keywords to help you find it. Like, I was trying to help one of my kids' friends Google on Social Security Administration what to do if his grandmother died, how to do a notification, and on the Social Security website, no matter what keywords we put in, we could not find it. He just went to Google, put it in, and it came up with the exact spot on Social Security Administration.
Right.
We have to look at it. It just shouldn't have been that hard. I mean, we shouldn't have found that on the Social Security Administration website, and we couldn't. So I just think that sometimes searching, especially these days, they're so good about searching, and it shouldn't be that Google gives them a better answer than the school website.
I think Google Analytics is better than some school.
And that could be why.
Web capabilities. You know what I mean? Like, I'd rather...
First sentence, and then you can get it all figured out. And the rest of it, so...
I thought that for those schools, even on the Town of Ed's website, they have things out there about, ITT. And so a lot of schools having problems. They say, I know there's a letter out there when ITT closed, and that's what they go to, because it's a quick place to go find what it is, rather than trying to find all the other places listed, but the comment says one spot.
Harry, will you coordinate the next meeting? Is it this...
Yeah,
Don't forget you gave the finance committee June off.
Yes.
Yes.
June finance is off.
June complaint is off?
Yes. That's true.
When is complaint?
I'll see you in September with my...
No,
we have a July. Make sure you have a
complaint.
Because July, there are quite a few new school acts.
Okay, so there is no June board meeting. They all look the same to me on my calendar. There is no June board meeting.
You're not on finance or complaints, so you're off.
So I'm going to cancel this puppy.
You are July, but you will probably get... We'll probably have to talk, I don't know, what to do on budget, but we'll get...
And that meeting is June 27th, right?
Complaint.
Yes.
Do we have any?
Well, we have that. Well, I have talked to you about the...
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We're having discussions afterwards.
So there may or may not...
Regardless, it's probably... How many do we need to require if there's three of us on there?
Have to have at least two.
Even if Dr. Lex is unable to make it, maybe there's value, and maybe telephonic even. Do board members have to actually be here?
We can have...
Oh, without a doubt. But for this one...
No, for the budget, we could do that by...
Yeah. So,
I like that.
So I was just thinking, if we don't have complaint, we don't have finance, we could at least consider something telephonically.
Yeah, we could.
And June maybe, I mean, telephonically.
No, June, I can't do June, because the budget's not even done.
Do we have any other business?
12:57. We're adjourned.